Welcome to the February 2018 episode of EMA. I'm here with Raman and Stuart. Good morning, guys.
Hi, guys. Hello, how everybody.
We're really excited to be here with you this month. We've got some great papers. Stuart, what do you think about the papers this month?
I think they're pretty amazing. I mean, there's a couple of duds in there. I'll leave that for you guys to pick out. Just one of them might have to do with the clavicle fracture. I think that was particularly suspect. But yeah, there's some great papers in there.
What are you going to get his clavicles?
You'll see. You'll see.
Well, we got people rising from the dead.
No, seriously speaking, though, like a lot of practical stuff, a few things I hadn't heard of before. It's really good. It's a really good selection this month.
It's a good mix. We've got peds, we've got ortho, we've got tox, we've got some snake bite. We got all kinds of stuff coming your way this month. So this month, in addition to our 30 fabulous abstracts, we have Rick's rants. He's going to be ranting about drug prices in the United States.
Yeah, something he knows nothing about.
And that should be depressing. And then we have time to talk a little nerdy about acute and chronic back pain in the ED.
Yeah.
Yay. A rare presentation.
Yes.
And then Reflections of a Skeptic. Jerry this month is going to talk about Methods Matter, reviewing chart reviews. A lot of our papers here on EMA are chart reviews, and so talking about the methods involved there, I think, is going to be really interesting to hear Professor Hoffman's take on that.
What do you think about that, Raman? You looking forward to that one?
Oh, yeah. He's taught me everything I know about chart reviews.
Chart reviews. And then that was then, this is now. This month, we're going to be talking about adenosine versus verapamil or diltiazem.
Very important.
Very important. Yep. It's going to be interesting stuff this month. A little smittering of this, a little smattering of that. And so any thoughts before we get started, gentlemen?
We'll see you guys on the other end.
Yeah, we'll see you on the other end.
Have at it.
Yeah. And here we go.
Let's go. Abstract number one, diagnosis and treatment of upper airway edema caused by acute angioedema in the emergency department, a French consensus statement by Flocard et al. In the European Journal of Emergency Medicine, October 2017.
That's a very realistic French accent you have. Do you speak French?
Flocard. That was my first language, but I've forgotten it all.
Well, not Flocard. You'd have them forgotten.
So let's hear what the French have to say about angioedema. This is an interesting article. It's a review article. It's an article that gives us 11 sort of consensus recommendations about the diagnosis and treatment of angioedema. There are parts of the study that I like, and there are parts of the study that we have issues with. So we actually had on a shift last night at LA County, we had three different patients come in with angioedema. Two of them were really sick. Two of them got intubated. One of them we didn't intubate, but we thought maybe she had hereditary angioedema. And we had all different flavors of angioedema last night.
So and how appropriate that we're talking about this morning.
The smorgasbord of different angioedema patients last night. And we're going to talk about all the different angioedema patients that could present to us and how these authors recommend we go about working them up. So what do I like about this paper? On the diagnostic path, they actually do a pretty nice job of helping us come up with a little algorithm for how to think about these patients. They give us a four-step approach. The four-step approach starts with, one, is it angioedema? That's a good question to ask. Sometimes, because the angioedema is typically non-pitting, tends to be localized to specific areas. So if you get pitting edema above the neck, maybe it's something more like an SVC syndrome. Something else might be going on. But first question is it angioedema? Second question, which is a really important question to ask because it affects all of our downstream management, is it histamine-mediated angioedema or is it bradykinin-mediated angioedema? And we all know the histamine-mediated angioedema or, you know, somebody eats some sesame seeds that they're allergic to and you get bad.
It's in the allergic family.
The allergic family, that's right. And they'll tend to have some itching or urticaria or some other signs of allergy associated with it versus the bradykinin type that's mediated by a different pathway doesn't have those same associated signs of urticaria and things that we typically see with allergies. Number three.
And they may have had it before.
You have?
No, and if it's bradykinin mediated, they may have had it before.
Oh, they may have had it before.
Yeah.
I was like, I just learned something new.
No.
Number three, is it anaphylaxis? So are we dealing with something that needs epi, et cetera? It's sort of the same concept as number two. And step number four, is the attack severe enough to warrant either airway management or medical management, or can we just sort of observe them?
Mm-hmm.
Which is, I think, a really good, important question to ask. And I think this is a great approach Where we start having some problems with this study is some of the treatment recommendations that they make. And here we go. We're back to the same sort of conflict of interest conversation, where a lot of these authors, when you look at the end of the article, they have affiliations with Shire Pharmaceuticals. That's the maker of icatibant. So we'll talk about why their recommendations aren't necessarily purely evidence-based, and there may be some conflicts of interest here.
Sounds like there are.
There are. So in terms of management of the airway and figuring out if the angioedema is bad enough to warrant airway management, there are a few signs that can help clue us in on whether or not there's laryngeal involvement. And they go through a whole little segment talking about some of the high-risk features. Is there dyspnea? Is there change in voice? Do they have hoarseness of their voice? Do they have stridor? When they have those signs, that makes us concerned that there's laryngeal involvement, and this is somebody that may need to get scoped or intubated soon. And then they talk about the treatments for the histamine-mediated. What are the treatments?
Allergy treatments.
Allergy stuff.
Right.
Antihistamines.
Right.
Your choice of
steroids.
Of how intense you want to treat them with epi, depending on how bad their disease is, steroids. Right. For the bradykinin-mediated, this is the point I want to highlight if anybody's reading this article for management purposes. There are essentially two different types of bradykinin-mediated things that are described. One is the hereditary or acquired angioedema patients that have C1 inhibitor deficiencies. Those patients, the evidence is pretty good telling us that C1 esterase inhibitor medications and bradykinin pathway blockers like icatibant or ecallantide can work in these patients and have worked in these patients. However,
they're a very small slice of the pie.
They are a very small slice of the pie. The majority of the ones we see, at least here in the U.S., are
ACE inhibitor.
ACE inhibitor angioedema. And those patients, we don't know what to do. We have no great treatment. So they end up being mostly airway management. Why don't we know what to do? There was one study in the New England Journal a few years back that gave us some promise of hope that maybe icatibant will work in these patients. It was a small study. It was published in the New England Journal. It was 27 patients.
Right.
There was it was a phase 2 study that showed benefit for icatibant in terms of how fast they progressed and how bad their disease got. But that study was repeated twice now with two different randomized control trials, larger studies. The biggest of one, the CAMEO trial, it was 120-some patients that showed no benefit whatsoever between giving icatibant versus placebo. And basically, the icatibant strategy has been debunked in ACE inhibitor-induced angioedema. There are some skeptics of that study that say, hey, they excluded the sickest of the sick.
And maybe it works in them.
And maybe it can work in them. But there's also, on the flip side, no great evidence to show that it does do something for ACE inhibitor-induced angioedema. Yet, if you look at their treatment algorithm, if they have any sort of bradykinin-mediated process, they recommend airway management and icatibant.
Including ACE inhibitor?
They don't really talk about it.
Got it.
They don't talk about it that it's a controversy. They don't talk about it that there's conflicting evidence, that people don't think that it's, a useful medication. If they had, I think it would give a lot more credence to the findings of the study. So you read this paper and there's all these great sort of approaches, strategies, just some good education in there. And then it sort of ends on this note where you're like, oh, conflict of interest again.
Yeah. Now, conflict of interest doesn't always mean that they're not right, but
That's true.
Sounds to me that they're stretching the evidence, you know. Yeah. Good education, though.
That's why it's good to go over.
Yeah. Liked it. Learned a lot.
Treat allergic angioedema the usual way, Benadryl, steroids, epinephrine. But bradykinin-induced and the really common one, ACE-induced, we're really not exactly sure what to do, but we do know that icatibant doesn't work very well.
Okay, abstract number 2, utility of the history and physical in the detection of acute coronary syndromes in emergency department patients. This is from the Western Journal of Emergency Medicine by Desmond plus Amal Matu from University from Maryland and Richard Bodie from Manchester, UK, who has also published extensively on this topic. This sounds like a pretty core topic to me, Raman. I mean, how useful is our H&P when we're looking at patients with chest pain that we're evaluating for acute coronary syndrome?
Yeah, we always talk about typical versus atypical symptoms. This is a great paper to look at to help tell us kind of what are typical and atypical symptoms.
Yeah. So, I mean, when you think about a patient, 50-year-old guy, he's coming in with chest pain, he's got discomfort, and he describes it as central chest, and he feels like it might be indigestion, and you ask all those classic questions. Does your pain radiate? Do you have this? Do you have that? Do you know in your mind what those likelihood ratios are for all those questions that you're asking? If they actually really increase or decrease?
I don't know the numbers, but there are things that concern me more. There are things that concern me less.
Yes, exactly. And there are things that should concern you more and concern you less, and this paper does a really good job reviewing all the literature that's out there on this topic that look at the various elements of our H&P and detecting ACS and give them numbers, likelihood ratios that help us remind us of the things that are valuable and the things that are not so valuable. And there are things that we ask questions that are also give us negative likelihood ratios, meaning that it's less likely that it's acute coronary syndrome. So what are some of the top questions, the most valuable, juicy likelihood ratios that actually sort of help rule in potentially someone that might have acute coronary syndrome? So pain radiating to the shoulders or both arms, that gives you a likelihood ratio 2.3. Pain to the right arm specifically is even
worse
a little higher, worse than the left, yeah. 2.6. Diaphoresis, it's really hard to fake diaphoresis. That's a pretty scary sign. That's somewhere between 1.4 and 6.4, depending on the source. Worse with exertion, it's a really important question, 1.8. And then there are things that decrease the likelihood of ACS. Reproducible chest wall tenderness. Pain that is pleuritic, sharp, or positional. What about the negative likelihood ratios on those? If it's pleuritic, that gives you 0.4. Sharp, 0.5. Gradual onset, like more than an hour, 0.7. So all those things that you use in your gestalt about what
less
kind
typical.
Of rules in and rules out and what's less typical, are they perfect? Should you count on them entirely? Of course not.
Nothing is ever perfect.
Nothing's ever perfect, especially not when it comes to history and physical. And we're combining this with objective things like our troponin, our EKG, et cetera.
I like the four Ps for the lower risk stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Palpation, pleuritic, positional, and here at County, we always say piquetes. Which is the sharp little stabbing pains.
Yeah. So none of these things are perfect,
yep.
Right? We have some gradation of what's a little better and what's a little bit worse. And when you add the troponin and the EKG, then, things start to look better. It's not all, just a cloudy day and nothing helps kind of thing. Now, the authors also do a brief tour through the world of traditional risk factors. They remind us that the Framingham risk factors are typical hypertension, hyperlipidemia, smoking, diabetes, all that stuff. Those are all also not perfect, and we certainly know that. And the patient in front of you, the N of one in front of you, has to be looked at in individual lens. Those are all not perfect as well. None of those are perfect, and neither is our individual physician gestalt, also not perfect. But I think this is a great paper to review those fundamentals when it comes to knowing the value of what you're asking your patients, what you're spending your time asking, what you're really looking for, and knowing a little bit about these likelihood ratios and how you risk stratify and how you use that data as you estimate pre- and post-test probabilities when you combine it. I think it's a really good review.
Yeah, I like it. Very practical.
History and physical can broadly define you as high risk or low risk, but you still need more in most patients for risk stratification.
All right. Abstract number 3, delayed return of spontaneous circulation, the Lazarus phenomenon after cessation of out-of-hospital cardiopulmonary arrest by Kuisma et al. In resuscitation, 2017. This is out of Finland. I really like this paper.
This paper scares me.
It worries me, too. I wonder. This paper and then doing a little bit more research on
mm-hmm.
this, it made me even more concerned than just the findings of this paper. All right. So, Jan, we have a patient that we've been doing CPR on for about 30 minutes. It doesn't seem like the resuscitation's going anywhere. We decide to call it time of death.
Uh-huh.
At that point, after knowing about this paper, do you feel comfortable calling the family in see their deceased relative?
Of course I do. That's what I've been doing for a long,
sure.
long time. And I don't think that I need to stand there and watch the dead person for, a certain amount of time. But this whole Lazarus phenomenon, are they going to have a swallow or a twitch or some kind of little, bump if I left them on the monitor?
Or a dramatic Game of Thrones, Jon Snow coming back to life kind of moment?
I mean... I hope that doesn't happen. Is that going to happen? What are you telling
so,
me?
This is what. So the author's conclusions here are that although rare, the Lazarus phenomenon can occur after cessation of CPR and may be underreported. International guidelines should recommend monitoring of patients for at least 10 minutes after stopping CPR. It is not common, but they say that it happens. So they actually did a prospective observational trial in Finland for 5 years, 2011 to 2016.
Looking for zombies? They're looking for zombies.
They were looking for the little mini zombie apocalypse in Finland. They looked at 2,000 out-of-hospital cardiac arrests over these several years. They found that 840 cases had CPR terminated in the field. Out of those 840 cases, 5 patients came back to life.
Now, they didn't really come back to life.
Come on, it's more fun when you say they came back to life. They had delayed return of spontaneous circulation. So they quantified that as 6 out of every 1,000 cases where patients had delayed ROSC. Return of spontaneous circulation. Oh. So, yes, they didn't stand up and, like, walk away from the scene.
Right.
But they did get pulses back. The timing for these patients was an average of between 3 to 8 minutes when this phenomenon occurred. The characteristics of these 5 cases. 3 of the cases had ultrasound-confirmed cardiac arrest. Like, there was no cardiac activity on the ultrasound, yet they regained pulses. 4 PEAs, 1 was asystole. 2 of the cases actually survived to the hospital, but both died prior to discharge. One of them was alive for 26 hours. That was a case of carbon monoxide poisoning. And one of them stayed alive for 1.5 hours. That was a case of hemorrhage. Now, looked back at a few of these kind of case reports on the Lazarus phenomenon, there is one case of a patient who's found alive in the freaking morgue. It's pretty freaking awful. Anyway, yes. So this probably does happen. I've heard stories like this before. I've never witnessed it myself. I don't know if you have. God.
Well, let me just say for a minute, one of the interesting things in this paper is, why do they watch people for 10 minutes in Finland, right? Where did this all come from?
Uh-huh. Yeah, they had a sentinel case.
Okay, they had a sentinel case. So they had this case in Finland that happened where this delayed return of spontaneous circulation, this kind of scenario occurred. And so it was a big legal case and got a lot of national attention. And so that's where this comes from, why they're even doing this at all.
Sure.
And basically they have a protocol where they monitor people. For 10 minutes after they call the code. What does that mean? What do they do when they monitor the people? They're saying that they're looking at an actual cardiac monitor, end-tidal CO2, and visual observation looking for breathing. And ultrasound where appropriate, they throw that in there. I think the truth is that probably a lot of the people that we do call, they might for a moment have a return of a pulse for a moment. Doesn't mean that they're going to get up and walk out of the hospital neuro intact, right? Mm-hmm. In fact, all of these 5 people that they describe with their Lazarus phenomenon, yes, they got pulses back. None of them lived to survive to anything.
And okay? You can't imagine that these patients that lived for 26 hours didn't get any major, major resuscitative interventions. It's not like they died and then they were just alive for 26 hours.
Yeah, I mean, in 2 of the cases, they had protocol violations, they said. In one case, the norepi drip that they had started during the resuscitation was still going when they called the code. That's not exactly a stoppage of resuscitation. Another one, they didn't actually disconnect the ventilator, you know, from the patient that they called the code. In Finland, they have, you know, physicians on scene that are doing some of this resuscitation. So it's not typical EMS. So do people that we call the code on have a momentary return of pulses for a moment, minutes after we call the code?
Yeah.
It could happen. Doesn't mean that they're going to live and walk out of the hospital. So, you know, I think it's an interesting concept. This probably does happen. Does it mean that we have to stand there and watch people for 10 minutes and leave them on the monitor? I mean, think about it as a family member, how traumatic that part might be. Mm-hmm. They've actually called the code. No one's doing anything and the monitor's still on. And what if they do get a blip?
Especially
or
in the age now where we're having families in the resuscitation, and then you're going to take them out of the resuscitation for 10 minutes and bring them back.
And then when they're watching the monitor for these 10 minutes and there is a blip and something does come back and nobody rushes in to do, I mean, are we going to, what do we do if you do see a blip?
I suppose you could give them an expectation that sometimes these are things that happen. Monitors might have a blip. You might see a breath.
Then why are we even looking for it if we're not going to do anything? So I sort of like back up and what's the practical application of it? It's interesting. It could happen. I don't know what to do with it. Their recommendation is you should watch them for 10 minutes. That's their protocol, and that's what you should do. I don't know if that's what you should do.
When pronouncing somebody dead, make sure they're actually dead.
Abstract number 4, angiotensin 2 for the treatment of vasodilatory shock, from the New England Journal of Medicine by Khanna et al. On behalf of the Athos 3 investigators. Athos stands for angiotensin 2 for the treatment of high output shock. These lead author here is from Melbourne, Australia. And so this is an interesting concept. We've got a new drug here on the horizon that I think we should know a little bit about. You know, Raman, when you have a patient who's got hypotension, you're starting pressors on, let's say it's septic shock, you've given them fluids, you got your norepi drip going, they're not really responding, what are your options?
More IV fluids?
Yeah.
Stronger antibiotics?
Yeah.
Stress dose steroids?
Right.
Maybe
very limited options.
Yeah.
Very limited options, right? So here we have a drug company sponsored trial. They're looking for the new great best thing in septic shock and vasopressor. Here's a new vasopressor for you. Now, just to back up and put this into context, have vasopressors ever been shown to really affect mortality, to really help patient-oriented outcomes and help people live longer? Do vasopressors do that?
Nope.
No, they don't. But do we use them? Sure we do. So this is a drug company sponsored trial. When I say drug company sponsored, I mean really drug company sponsored. They actually, you know, these days they have to in manuscripts describe what the drug company sort of contributed to the project. Was it just the money, but people wrote the paper independently? Was it this? Was it that? The drug company is all over this paper. They were there from the research collection all the way to the writing, although certainly there were clinicians involved as well. But this has really got the pharma fingers in it. And basically their conclusion is going to be that angiotensin 2, which is a drug that's not actually available right now, but this research medication is a potential new vasopressor in catecholamine-resistant vasodilatory shock. And so that is what they want us to think. We're going to walk away thinking, we got a new option here, and I can't wait for this drug to come out. I think that's what they want you to feel.
Yep.
So what did they actually do? They looked at patients who had shock. These were patients who were sick in the ICU, hypotensive. They've gotten some fluids. They're on a catecholamine drip, epinephrine, norepi, something. They could even be on and vasopressin. All of those are possibilities, and they're not responding. And so now we're going to add in the study drug, and we're going to look, what is our outcome of interest? Is it that patients live longer and do better and have better mortality? No. What we're actually studying is whether or not those numbers improve a little bit. Right at the 3-hour mark, let's just look at one point in time, and we're going to look to see if their MAP bumps up a little bit, and that is our outcome right
three
there.
Hours.
At the 3-hour mark, does our MAP bump up a certain predefined endpoint? And indeed, it looks like the numbers are a little bit better at that little point in time, that little snapshot you give this new drug versus not having this new drug.
Cha-ching.
Cha-ching. It looks like it's better. So, you know, obviously you can tell from the tone of my voice and the opinion here of the speaker that I don't think this is a great outcome. This is certainly not a patient-oriented outcome. This is a number outcome. But this was obviously a big trial. This was at 75 ICUs across North America, Australia, Europe. It's randomized, double-blind, placebo-controlled trial over 1.5 years, 1.5 years. So it's a long trial. These are all adult ICU patients. Again, as I said, they've already gotten the standard stuff. They're on a catecholamine drip, and now we're going to add this in. How many patients were in this trial? 344 patients enrolled. Not that many when you talk about 75 ICUs. Of those patients, about half and half in the drug group, half in the placebo group. Sepsis was the cause of their shock in 80%, but please note that these are patients who all have good cardiac outputs. This is not cardiogenic shock. This is high output type of shock. And 70% of the drug group had a bump in their blood pressure, and 24% of the placebo group had a bump in their blood pressure. A quarter of the placebo group also had a bump in their blood pressure right at that time snapshot that they're looking at. So yes, the drug group did a little bit better, but a quarter of the placebo group got a little bit better. But hey, the drug group got better, so we're going to sell that point. They basically make the point that during the first 48 hours of care, you don't need as many catecholamine vasopressors if you use this new drug, if you add this sort of on top, layer it on top of your catecholamine drips that you have going already. And that's sort of the advantage of this drug, that you're going to be able to back off your catecholamines, and now you have this other option that you can throw in there. So, Raman,
yep.
Are you looking forward to the debut of angiotensin 2?
Yeah. I'm going to throw all my money at this med and bring it in.
Are you buying stock right now?
Patient's blood pressure for a few hours. You know, this is all sort of non-patient-oriented outcomes. And the ones that are patient-oriented outcomes, it doesn't make a difference in terms of mortality. Here's some numbers. I was reading a little bit about the background of this study. Lakhmir Chawla, who's the trial investigator and also CMO of La Jolla Farm, after the trial, they reported a 16% increase in La Jolla stock, forecasting prices of at $5,000 to $8,000. Annual sales are expected and forecasted to be at $500 million to $1.5 billion for the marketing distribution of this medication. It is always hard to separate out what the motivations are for these medications. And there is a huge financial incentive for this medication to get sold. We don't know if it's going to work or help in terms of patient outcomes. So, but I am almost certain we'll see it.
Of course. Just so you know what the mortality was in this cohort, 7-day all-cause mortality was 29% of the drug group versus 35% of the placebo. So about in third in both groups. Mm-hmm. It wasn't powered to look at mortality as their point, but there wasn't any advantage. And the confidence interval goes right across one. So it's not significant in terms of that, but they just qualify that by saying, well, that's not what we were looking at. We were looking at this MAP endpoint. Look at the numbers bump up a little bit. You'll feel better.
Angiotensin II infusion did not result in better patient-oriented outcomes in vasodilatory shock.
Abstract number 5, prevalence of pulmonary embolism in patients presenting to the emergency department with syncope by Frizel et al. From the American Journal of Emergency Medicine.
I thought it was Frizel. I don't know.
From Utah. July 2017. So this is a case that we're going to be coming up with a lot, especially in light of a recent article. This article, to me, is almost in response to the HESET trial that had come out last year in the New England Journal saying that 1 in 6 patients with syncope end up having a PE.
Right.
There's a lot more nuance to it, and we'll get into that. But so say we have a youngish patient. He's sitting around. He's doing his little morning routine. He's reading his newspaper in the bathroom, and he pushes too hard, and he passes out.
Okay.
He comes to your ER.
That sounds like poop syncope.
Poop syncope. But 1 out of 6 syncope patients have a PE. Are we working up all these patients? Say if it's even a more high-risk patient, you know, like somebody's – nobody knows what the circumstances were they pass out. Are we keeping that number in mind? 1 out of 6 syncope patients have a PE. Do we need to be working these up every single time? Everyone gets a CTPA now? But syncope?
No. I mean, I think we've done a good job debunking the PESET trial through lots of review. We've done it on EMA. We did it on Paper Chase. So I think we all realize that there were a lot of issues with that paper. But I agree with you. I think this is sort of a real-world response to that paper to sort of say, hey, wait a minute. Let's look at what this really is in the ED in all comers with syncope.
And what I like about this trial is this has some face validity. These numbers that we're going to talk about in this trial seem a lot more true to life to what we see in our practice. So the author's conclusions in this trial, we'll start with, they say that according to their data, pulmonary embolism is an infrequent cause of syncope in patients presenting to the emergency department. In their trial, they find that only 1.4% of their patients had PE in the setting of syncope. And they go on to say that their findings disagree with a recent study reporting a higher rate, nearly 1 in 6, although differences in methodology may explain some of this discrepancy. So both trials, obviously the PESET from last year and this trial, have some methodological flaws. But we'll talk a little bit about what they did here and whether we're buying or selling on this. In this trial, they did a retrospective secondary analysis of syncope patients that presented to the University of Utah Emergency Department from 2010 to 2015. They looked at about 350 patients that presented with syncope.
Wait a minute. 350 patients over 5 years?
Right. Well, I think they were enrolling for another trial, and this is so I don't necessarily know what all the inclusions were for
their enrollment rate was
analysis.
A little low. Let's
it is
just
a little
say
low.
There. Yeah. Okay.
And they discharged about half of the patients, and they admitted to inpatient or OBS the other approximately half of their patients. And then they looked at how many of these patients ended up getting diagnosed with a pulmonary embolism. It turns out in their inpatient and observation cohort, 0 patients got diagnosed with a PE, interestingly. In the patients that were discharged, who they ended up following up at 30 days, 3 of them were ultimately diagnosed with a pulmonary embolism, and the other 2 patients were diagnosed in the ED. So out of their about 350 patients, they had only 5 patients that ended up getting diagnosed with a pulmonary embolism.
for a total percent of
1.4%.
1.4%.
What are the methodological flaws here? They were able to follow up about 68% of their patients. 32% are lost to follow-up. This is retrospective. It's not entirely clear what happened with all of these patients down the line. The one thing that they did that the PESET trial didn't do is the PESET trial only looked at patients that were admitted to the hospital. So, right. And that's not what we see. We see all comers.
Right.
So in the PESET trial, they said that 1 in 6 of their patients had PEs, but that was only 1 in 6 of hospitalized patients. If you took the all comers in that trial, that number would have been closer to about 3 or 4% of their patients, even in their study, would have had a PE. So I think that this study is limited by the attrition to follow up, but it's much closer to sort of the face validity of what we see in terms of the relation between syncope and PE. Neither study tells us anything about isolated cases of syncope, which is, I think, ultimately what that PESET trial was trying to tell us. But we didn't know what any of the clinical features were for those syncope patients. So in that trial, even those 1 in 6 hospitalized patients may have all had tachycardia, hypoxemia, shortness of breath, pleuritic chest pain, and nobody would have missed it. The real question is, are there cases of isolated syncope without any of those clinical signs that would have made us concerned in the first place that are presenting with syncope? And then ultimately, would it matter even if we caught it? Would they have any bad clinical outcomes?
What was reassuring here is that all the patients that had a PE were positive on the PERC. They were short of breath. I mean, they had physical signings. These were not hidden PEs.
Right.
They had physical signs. So I agree. I think it highlights what we believe, which is that if you have a PE causing your syncope, there's going to be some hint, you know, to you when they come in. And indeed, in this study, they did.
Yeah.
Of the 5 people who did it, they had stuff. They had calf pain or swelling, or they had, you know, shortness of breath. You know, they had some issue. And even the ones that ended up being followed and got a PE down the road, when they describe those cases, which they do in the paper, they discuss sort of how long it was before they were diagnosed with their PE. The fact that, for example, one of them had a negative D-dimer in the ED. And so there are going to be some misses, but they're going to have negative workups. This very much highlights the real-world experience that
we
all have.
I think so, too. Yeah, pulmonary embolism continues to be the great masquerader, but every patient with syncope does not need a workup for it.
I thought syphilis was the great masquerader.
Ooh, that is another
good one. TB was the great masquerader.
They're all good masqueraders.
Yeah.
In this study, pulmonary embolism was a rare cause of syncope, in juxtaposition to a recent article which was poorly done and said it was 20% of syncope patients.
Abstract number 6. This is a big one, Raman. Validation of the Ottawa subarachnoid hemorrhage rule in patients with acute headache. This is in the Canadian Medical Association Journal by Perry et al., along with his Ottawa friends. Perry is a big one in this area of publication. This is also Ian Steele and Wells, you know, all the big ones here.
Big topic.
So, Raman, when you're seeing patients with your rule-out subarachnoid, bad headache, how do you decide what to do with them?
Gestalt.
Gestalt. All right. I like it. Do you use a rule?
I don't have rules.
All right. Well, I got a rule for you.
Ruleless.
It's a clinical decision tool, not so much a rule, but we should know about it, right? So the Ottawa subarachnoid rule is something that was published before. This paper here is the validation set in 1,700 patients looking at this clinical decision rule. What is the Ottawa subarachnoid hemorrhage rule? It is pretty straightforward. There are 6 things that you got to look for when you see your patients, okay? If they have one of the following 6 things, then they need to be evaluated for subarachnoid hemorrhage. But if they don't have one of the following 6 things, then you are safe to say that it's negative. Now, these authors say, I just wanted to give you the conclusion here, they say that this rule is 100% sensitive in identifying subarachnoid hemorrhage. Now, it's not so specific, 13.6% specific,
but
it is.
But we can rule out.
But we can rule out. So what are the 6 things? Okay, number 1, do they have symptoms of neck pain or stiffness? Number 2, are they over age 40? Number 3, did they have witness loss of consciousness? Number 4, was the onset of the headache during exertion? Number 5, thunderclap headache, meaning that they had peak pain within an hour? Or number 6, do they have limited neck flexion on exam? Those are your 6 features to look for.
Yeah, in patients that had headaches reaching a max onset within an hour.
Correct.
Only
that's your thunderclap headache.
Yeah.
Correct. And these are patients, non-traumatic headache, adult patients coming to the ED. So if they have none of those 6 things,
adios.
You can say, not a subarachnoid, not going down that pathway. Now, if they do have one of the 6 things, all it says is you got to evaluate them for a subarachnoid hemorrhage. Doesn't mean you have to do the whole workup. Means you have to think about it.
We're back where we started with our gestalt.
but it helps us rule some people out.
Okay.
Yeah.
How well did it do that?
So they 100% sensitive.
Yeah.
13.6% specific.
I guess how well did it help us to reduce the number of studies we were doing?
So that's the problem. If you use the rule, you're going to get a lot of people that are going to rule in, right? You're going to get people who have one of those six features. Mm-hmm. And so you're going to get a lot of people who, that's why it's sensitive. It's very, very sensitive. You're going to get people who are going to fall into the positive side of this algorithm. And you're still going to end up using your decision making about what to do about that. And even in this study, not all of the clinicians did the full workup. About 88% of them got CTs. About a third of them got LPs. So there's still some decision making to be done, but it will help you rule out a good chunk of people.
Yeah, because it sounds like, looking at some of the numbers here, it says that 89% of the patients got an actual investigation of the patients that had max onset headache within an hour. That's a lot, 89% of them. So we're saying these are pretty high risk. But if we were to apply this, the Ottawa subarachnoid hemorrhage rule,
right,
that this would decrease the investigation rate to 84%.
Yeah. It's not going to save you a lot of workups.
Yeah.
That's not what it's for.
Okay.
But it is going to identify a subset of patients who are negative.
The Ottawa subarachnoid rule has been validated by the Ottawa group. Use it if you like.
Abstract number 7, suicide following deliberate self-harm, by Olfsen et al. In the American Journal of Psychiatry, published in 2017. All right, we'll start off with a case. 50-year-old male is found with a gun, waving it in his house, saying, "I need to end my life." He has no history of depression or any mental health condition. What are the chances that he'll come back to the emergency department for another episode of self-harm? And what are the chances that he'll actually complete his suicide at some point?
Waving a gun, that doesn't sound good. That sounds like a lethal potential method. I think the chances are pretty high.
I'd say they're pretty high, too.
Yeah.
And this is what the authors...
If he doesn't get shot by the cops first.
Yeah. So this guy does have a high chance of coming back. The author's conclusions in this study are that these results indicate that persons who inflict deliberate self-harm, especially when using firearms, have a high risk of repeated self-harm and suicide during the following year, and especially within the first month. So not only is this patient at high risk over the course of the next year, but specifically in the short term, this patient is going to be at high risk. The authors in this paper reviewed a Medicaid database from 45 states from 2001 and 2007. They looked at adults aged 18 to 64 who had a diagnosis of deliberate self-harm at their index visit. And then they looked forward to see how many of these patients had a repeat visit for self-harm. And that was about 20% of patients within the year had another visit for repeat self-harm. The completed rate of suicide, however, was pretty low compared to that number at 0.4%, but still significant. That number, 0.4% of those patients, is still 37 times more than the general population.
37 times more.
Yeah, wow. So we have an obligation to ensure good follow-up. That number goes from 0.4% to 5% of patients with firearms who have attempted deliberate self-harm with a violent means such as firearms. 5% of those will go on to complete their suicide within the year, and most of them within that first month. That's 100 times more likely than with nonviolent methods. So what does this all mean for us on the front lines? Obviously, if you have somebody with a violent deliberate self-harm attempt, we got to take that extremely seriously. I can't imagine ever not putting anybody like that on a hold,
right,
even if they're able to articulate to you that they're not suicidal at that time. It's a pretty scary thing, and the numbers are pretty staggering. So I have 3 major takeaways from this, that whether or not they get put on a hold and a PET team eval or a mental health team comes in, I still would want to at least have this conversation with the patient that even beyond this ED visit, that the follow-up is critical, that many of these patients, about 40% they cite in this study, have not had any mental health care within the 6 months preceding their attempt. So even starting the conversation and planting the seed, sort of the same way we do with palliative care and talking about goals of care before somebody goes to the ICU. Maybe we're not taking care of them in the ICU, but we can start the discussion and let patients know that it's important. It's the same kind of thing. I think we can start that discussion about how important it is for them to get that follow-up that they need when they leave. Number 2, lethal means counseling. If a patient is there, and especially if they're there with family and they had an episode like this, waving the gun, to have some sort of conversation with the family about the risk that that firearm or any kind of violent method in the house, if you can just eliminate some of that for that patient or all of that,
yeah.
ideally, that can make a big difference. And last thing is concept of safety planning that I've gotten now into the habit of. There's a website, sprc.org, Suicide Prevention Resource Center. .org. So SPRC.org. They have a little template for safety planning. Basically, you give it to any patient that comes in with a suicidal attempt. They get to write down exactly what are my warning signs, who can and who will I contact the next time I feel bad or I feel isolated. And it's sort of an empowering tool for patients to take home with them, whether or not they get that at the next facility that they're at during their hold. So I thought the numbers here were staggering. I think this is a place where we can actually make a difference and intervene as emergency docs. What do you think, Jen?
The other mechanism I want to remind people about is single vehicle motor vehicle accidents.
Absolutely.
You know, when we see the patient in the trauma
yep.
bay who was in a car accident, you know, you really have to be that detective and ask, how did this car accident happen? What was the mechanism here? And when it sounds fishy mm-hmm. and we're not sure exactly what happened or how the accident happened, you have to think about this as a potential mechanism for suicide.
Fall from 15 feet.
Yeah.
Motor vehicle
exactly.
accidents.
So many
of these.
In yep. these trauma patients who survive their event, mm-hmm. always, I really like to say, you have to have a real clear picture in your mind of what happened in this event. If you're not really sure what happened in this mm-hmm. event or it sounds mm-hmm. fishy, you have to consider this might have been a self, you know, harm type of event and think of it that way. But we don't think that way in the trauma bay. We're thinking about resuscitation and we've got to think this way because that's often how they come in. They're a trauma patient. We're not layering this level on top of it, but we really have to think about it.
What a great point. And emergency physicians, always, we have to think about things in so much context.
Yeah. What a hard job we have.
In patients who use very violent methods to attempt suicide, they are more likely to complete suicide within the next month.
Abstract number 8. This is called Analysis of ED Length of Stay for Mental Health Patients at 10 Massachusetts Emergency Departments. This is from Annals of Emergency Medicine. The author is Perlmutter et al. From Tufts. I mean, it is no secret that mental health is a crisis right now in terms of boarding times, impact on emergency departments. It's something that's really reached national attention. And this is a nice paper that looks and quantifies what that means in Massachusetts. Previous work has shown that we know this from our everyday experience, that mental health patients wait more than 3 times longer for an inpatient bed than a non-mental health admission. There was another study that showed for every mental health admission that sat in your ED, you are preventing about 2.2 bed turnovers, which costs your ED about $2,000 for every one of those that's sitting around waiting to get admitted. So why does it take so long? Is it the medical clearance aspect of things? I think we all have an instinctual answer to that question. Is it just the boarding time? And does insurance status matter? And this is what these authors really wanted to focus in on. They wanted to quantify that burden of mental health boarding in EDs across Massachusetts and look at that variation in length of stay for mental health patients by insurance type, as well as break down all those components of why they're sitting around in the ED. Is it the medical clearance? Is it the mental health team response time and evaluation? Is it just the boarding time? So they looked at this observationally at 10 different hospitals in Massachusetts, a mix of community EDs and academic EDs. And they had an abstractor at each site who was taking out all this data and kind of recording it all. So what did they find? They found, not surprisingly, that the mean length of stay for mental health patients was about 4 to 5 times higher when you compared it to the mean length of stay for regular old med-surg patients
that
across
sucks.
This 2-week study period.
If you have a physical problem, you're going to wait a lot less than if you have mental health issue.
That's right. You're going to wait a lot less than if you have a mental health issue. And across these different hospitals, it was mostly young adults that were struggling with their mental health issues, younger on the younger side as compared to a lot of medical surgical problems. The overall total median length of stay for these patients was about 11 hours. Wow, 11 hours. And insurance status did make a difference. The self-pay and uninsured patients had the longest total length of stay as compared to the other insurance types. No surprise that if you needed to be admitted or transferred, your length of stay was going to be significantly longer than if you didn't need those things. And what was interesting, and I think proves a point that we all are aware of, medical clearance is not the problem. Medical clearance was similar for all patients. It took about 1.5 hours, no matter what your insurance type was, very small fraction of the total problem. And it didn't vary much by what their disposition or insurance status was. That was not the problem. That's not the bottleneck. So it really highlights inequity in care for mental health patients. When you compare the effect of insurance on this problem, you see really great disparities in care by different insurance type, which shouldn't be. And we know that really focusing in on the medical clearance part of things, which we do spend a lot of time talking about unnecessary testing and this kind of thing for psych patients, but that's not really going to solve this problem. This is going to have to be something that's solved at really, I mean, it's going to be a local, regional, state, national type thing. What are your thoughts on this, Robin?
I think the inequity of care for mental health patients kind of reflects the values that we have about mental health in general when we compare it to a physical ailment. That we're okay with not getting these patients up and not getting them taken care of the same way we do for physical ailments. And there's nothing worse than being on a shift and seeing somebody who's anxious, may have just had a suicidal attempt, and just sitting there for 2 days in your emergency department with nobody really
doing anything
for them.
Right.
And everybody telling them to get back in that dang bed and just sit there. You know, like how much more ignored can you feel?
Yeah, I
agree. I think systemic changes are in order. I don't know when or how they'll come, but
yeah,
this just highlights more of the issue that we all know exists.
That's right.
Mental health patients wait a long time for beds, especially if they're poor and underinsured.
Abstract number 9, estimated impact of emergency medical service triage of stroke patients on comprehensive stroke centers, an urban population-based study by Katz in Stroke 2017. This is a study looking at where stroke patients go, whether they go to comprehensive stroke centers versus primary stroke centers. So we have a 60-year-old male with dense hemiparesis at home. He's been having symptoms for 4 hours. The family calls EMS. Currently, many of these patients go into primary stroke centers. The authors are wondering whether these patients should be going to comprehensive stroke centers and if it's feasible.
And it's not just the authors who are wondering that. A lot of pre-hospital care systems are wondering and being told that we should be bypassing primary stroke centers to go to these comprehensive stroke centers. So what is the impact of that?
Why do we need to go there? So the comprehensive stroke centers, what is it? What does that even mean? So basically these centers have readily available MRIs, advanced imaging. They have interventional neurologists, the neurosurgeons, they have neuro ICUs. And they have the capability to handle subarachnoid hemorrhages, intracranial hemorrhages, and large ischemic strokes. So why did these recommendations start? We've been reviewing this stuff on the abstracts for a while. And a lot of this has to do with the endovascular stroke therapies and the promising results that we've gotten from the recent trials. The AHA advocates for transporting appropriate stroke patients to go to comprehensive stroke centers if the transport time is less than or equal to 15 minutes when compared to a primary stroke center.
So it can't be 15 to 20 minutes farther, for example. It has to be
18 minutes.
Yes.
No. Go to the primary stroke center.
Right.
14 minutes.
It's an arbitrary cutoff. For sure.
So should we be doing this? We know that a lot of those trials that we looked at, and we talk about this over and over again, that the selection criteria for those patients was extremely tight, that there weren't that many patients that were included in those studies that benefited. In the Mr. Clean trial and other trials, there was something like a patient per center per month. But now we're remapping our entire EMS system for patients to go to these comprehensive stroke centers to have a chance at a better outcome. They reviewed a huge registry of stroke adult patients in Cincinnati and Northern Kentucky from 2010. They looked at 2,700 adult stroke patients. About 900 of those patients were transported from their residence to the hospital. In those patients, they looked to see what the transport times were for primary stroke centers and what they would have been had they gone to a comprehensive stroke center. So what they find, the mean travel time to a primary stroke center was about 11 and a half minutes, a maximum transport time of 50 minutes. The mean travel time for comprehensive stroke centers was 19.4 minutes, so not that much different. They looked and said, well, if all those patients that had less than 15 minutes additional transport time went to comprehensive stroke centers, out of their 929 patients, 727 of them would have gone to comprehensive stroke centers, meaning, holy wow, almost all of these patients would have gone to comprehensive stroke centers.
Right.
And these primary stroke centers would be
left in the dust.
Left in the dust. That's
right. One of the interesting stats they gave in this paper, they said if every suspected stroke was initially taken to a comprehensive stroke center by EMS, by their calculations, a median of about 43 patients would be diverted from each primary stroke center to a comprehensive stroke center each year, which doesn't sound like a lot. But, you know, if you think about a primary stroke center in, you know, a small town or in a, you know, relatively small population area, diverting these patients away from you is lost revenue. That is one aspect of this. And we really don't know right now who should be going to the comprehensive stroke center and who shouldn't. And so the authors here suggest some guidelines. For example, should we be doing some kind of stroke score, you know, an NIH stroke scale measurement?
Like greater than 10,
exactly.
They say
greater than 10 would kind of help you with stroke severity. That might be one way that you could do it.
Because those patients are at higher risk for large vessel occlusions that may be amenable to endovascular.
Exactly. And then if you take into some of the time considerations, for example, if we want to put some time of onset recommendations along with it, maybe we can decrease this number, but we really don't know who should be in the bus bypassing the comprehensive or bypassing the primary stroke center going to the comprehensive center right now. I think you have to do this type of analysis by community. These are all different communities with different implications for this type of a rule. And so, you know, this is, I like this analysis. I think it's very, it applies to the greater Cincinnati and northern Kentucky region, but for other EMS systems where the time variability is different, the patients are different, the implications financially for hospitals are different, you got to do this type of analysis to really take a closer look at it.
Yep. Whatever does end up happening is going to have huge, huge, major financial implications and impacts on these primary stroke centers.
You're going to swing a lot of patients to these comprehensive stroke centers and bypass a lot of the other hospitals, which may not be such a good thing.
If we send every single suspected stroke to a stroke center, those stroke centers are going to be crushed.
Abstract number 10. This is called upgoing thumb sign, a sensitive indicator of brain involvement, from the journal Neurology by Hutchinski et al. From the University of Western Ontario.
Yeah, a thumbs up isn't always a good thing.
Thumbs up isn't always a good thing. I think that's probably a great alternative title for this paper. University of Western Ontario, I think that Stuart Swadron is an alum of this fine institution. So this better be high quality stuff. Let's see. So let's say, Raman, that you're seeing a person got some, maybe some stroke symptoms, a little weakness here or there, maybe a TIA, you're doing your neuro exam. Do you look for a thumbs up sign?
You ever heard of that? But I may after today.
You may after today? Well, let's see. So the authors here are suggesting that an upgoing thumb sign seems to be a sensitive, reliable, and simple maneuver to distinguish patients with a transient ischemic attack or stroke from those with stroke mimics. Can this sign actually distinguish between the two? Can we believe this? Yeah, probably. I think it's probably as good a thing as there is in the neuro exam, which is to say that it's not that great, but neither is anything else in the neuro
exam.
And
every physical exam finding ever.
Right.
As always, cannot rule in and cannot rule out.
There you go. That's kind of the perfect summary here. So what is this upgoing thumb sign? How do you do it? Well, we all know about the Babinski sign. This is very similar to the Babinski sign. And in fact, there's a lot of different sort of odd reflexes that you can elicit in people who have upper motor neuron problems. The way that you do the upgoing thumb sign is you have patients are sitting up in a chair. They don't have to be in a chair. They have to be sitting up. They place their hands over their knees and their arms are straight out. Straight at the elbows, and they keep their fingers kind of all locked together in a row, the thumb on top of the second finger on top of the third finger, and so on, with the palms facing one another. And then you basically have them raise their arms fairly quickly towards their shoulders, and as they do that, you watch them. And if their thumb extends at some point during that maneuver, that's called a thumbs-up sign.
This is a lot more helpful if you can actually see Jan doing it in person.
I know.
Well, and if you can't, you can YouTube it. They have quick videos that you can see.
It's pretty straightforward, though.
Yep.
They put their hands out. You watch their hands go up. And also, if they have a lag in one side or the other, that also is a positive sign. But basically, you get extension of the thumb or an upgoing thumb sign. And this is like a Babinski. And so they looked at this sign and they looked at a bunch of patients who had stroke mimics and other people who had real strokes. And they had two different investigators sort of watch this physical exam finding and rate it as positive or negative. And then they gave us some sensitivity and specificity. And it's not perfect. The numbers are not great. I will tell you that right now. You're not going to find that this is exclusively positive in people who have a real stroke versus stroke mimics, but it is more positive in people who have actual strokes than in stroke mimics. It's more frequently positive in patients with real pathology. It's a really quick maneuver to add to your neuro exam. And so I think it's worth knowing about, especially, you know, Babinski's sign and rubbing the bottom of the foot is not comfortable for patients. It's actually kind of painful if you're doing it properly. So this might be an easier way to do it. And since you're already, doing part of your neuro exam often in a sitting up position, this is just something to add and to look for this upgoing thumb sign. One of the things they did point out is that the inter-rater reliability was better with this particular neuro finding than with Babinski.
Interesting. I thought one thing that was interesting, they said, 60% of patients with a TIA or stroke had the upgoing thumb sign versus 40% of patients with stroke mimics. When I looked at that number, I was like, how is that helpful? But they then go back and say that a majority of those patients that had stroke mimics that had the upgoing thumb sign had a history of a TIA or stroke.
There you go.
And I think it was 23 out of 26 of those patients had a history of. So I'm willing to give it a fly.
I think you give it a fly. I mean, this is my first time I've heard of it, and I'm interested. So let's give it a try. Upgoing thumb sign. Love to hear what people think about it.
An upgoing thumb in a patient with suspected stroke or TIA can suggest that they've actually had a stroke or TIA.
Abstract number 11, effect of the Affordable Care Act Medicaid expansion on emergency department visits, evidence from state-level emergency department databases by Nick Pei, hope I said that right, Annals of Emergency Medicine, August 2017. This is a paper looking at the impact of Medicaid expansion after the 2014 rollout of the Patient Protection and Affordable Care Act that is currently still in existence. And it's specifically looking at the impact that the ACA had on the change in the number of emergency department visits and the change in the emergency department payer mix.
So
intuitively, what do we think would happen to both of those?
So if I'm a politician, I think that by putting this ACA into place, ED visits are going to go down because everyone's got access to primary care. Is that what happened?
Yeah. Except that it's Medicaid.
And right.
Primary care physicians are tough to get into when you have Medicaid. A lot of them have full practices. A lot of them don't accept Medicaid. And it turns out that Medicaid is pretty good for the ER, that a lot of times we don't have copays with Medicaid. There's no financial real disincentives for patients. There are all sorts of patient satisfaction measures now trying to get the provider the door times down and everything else. So the care in the ED is pretty good and we can get a lot of stuff done. So if I'm a patient and I got my Medicaid card and I can't find a primary doctor because there ain't nobody that wants to see me in the next 3 months and I don't have a copay to go to the ER,
guess what?
I'm going to the ER.
Yeah.
and that's the bottom line of this of this study. The other thing that they find is obviously the change in the payer mix. As expected, in states that had Medicaid expansion, the percentage of patients with Medicaid went up and the uninsured rates went down.
So how much did it go up? How many?
So
give me some basics.
Yeah, that's fine. So Medicaid, the percentage of patients with Medicaid went up by 8.8%. The percentage of patients that were uninsured went down by 5.5%.
Okay.
Ultimately, you know, this paper, I talked to Jerry Hoffman about this last night. He said one thing that I thought was really important. This paper can't and doesn't address whether the emergency department care was appropriate and whether it cost or saved money.
Right.
The bigger question here is, do we want patients to have care? And if we're going to have an insurance structure where it's easier to get in the ER, people go to the ER. If we have an insurance structure where it's easier to get in primary care, maybe we'll start using primary care. Hopefully we'll get there one day. But until then, right now, it looks like the impact so far has been a little bit increase in ED visits, probably and maybe for appropriate care, but we don't know that.
Got it.
Patients with insurance tend to go to the emergency department a little bit more often than if they don't have insurance. But what does that all mean?
Abstract number 12, the efficacy of crotalidae polyvalent immune Fab antivenom versus placebo plus optional rescue therapy on recovery from copperhead snake envenomation, a randomized, double-blind, placebo-controlled clinical trial from the Annals of Emergency Medicine by Gerardo et al., who's from Duke, but written on behalf of a bunch of smart toxicologists from different institutions. So I don't know if you've ever seen a copperhead snake bite, Rob.
Not in California.
We don't see that here, but if you did see a copperhead snake bite, would you give them antivenom?
I don't know.
Okay. Well, it turns out that copperheads, which are crotalids, remember that crotalids include rattlesnakes and copperheads and cottonmouths as well. You have this antivenom. We've got Crofab. We've got this antivenom that we can use. And we know that rattlesnake bites are pretty bad. It turns out that copperhead bites, which are about half of the reported crotalid bites in the country, copperhead envenomation is less severe than rattlesnake bites.
Not fatal.
Not fatal, not as bad as a rattlesnake bite. But when you do get bit on your limb, you get a lot of pain, you get a lot of swelling, but the systemic venom effects are pretty uncommon and death is really rare. So we don't really have a lot of data about what to do with these when it comes to giving these copperhead snake bite victims Crofab or not. Should you give them the antivenom? So this paper looks at this, and they did a randomized controlled trial here, and the outcome here was not death, because it doesn't happen that often in copperhead bites. It's about improved limb function. When you get bitten on your arm or your leg, how does your limb do? And it turns out that antivenom probably does have a positive effect on limb function. It does. People get better a little bit faster, and their limb does better. So that's important. I would like my limb to work. That's good. They measured it at the time of envenomation. They looked again at 14 days, and it looks like people got better. They had 76 patients that were randomized. 47 of them got allocated to the treatment group. 29 of them got placebo, and they did pretty well. Now, let's talk about the cost of this antivenom, because this is
expensive
stuff. Okay. Would you treat somebody with a copperhead bite? In this study, they gave them six vials initially. Six vials. How much does one vial of this stuff cost? Well, it turns out that the charges for this are about $2,000 to $3,000 a vial. $2,000 to $3,000 a vial, okay? And then the patients got two more vials at 6, 12, and 18 hours later. So
two vials at each time point?
Correct. So this is very expensive stuff. Mm-hmm. Now, the outcome is their limb did better. So how much is
a
it worth
better?
To you
a
for your limb
better.
To do better? It did better. It did better. The truth is, though, that all the patients did fine.
Okay.
I mean, all the patients do fine. Mm-hmm. People aren't losing limbs.
Yeah.
It's just that the limb gets better faster. They can use it faster. It feels better faster, okay? But that's, is it worth it? The cost of this stuff. I don't know. Now, this is a pretty small study. They reached the end of their funding before they could reach all of their patients that they wanted to enroll. They had a lot of mild bites in here. Now, these, they excluded people who had really, really severe bites. Those people were out. They were looking at the mild to moderate group, but of mild to moderate, there were a lot more on the mild side of the spectrum. And so this cost question is a big one in my mind. We can say, yeah, outcomes in the mild to moderate copperhead envenomations, they're generally good, even in the placebo group, and maybe the antivenom does better for limb function, but at a pretty, pretty, pretty high cost.
And it's on day 14 that they're a little bit better, but it sounds by 4 months, all patients had recovered.
Right. That's what I'm saying.
Okay.
By 4 months, they're all the same. But by day 14, the ones that got the expensive stuff did a little better.
Gotcha.
Yeah. Is it worth it? Hmm. Up to you.
Yeah, a few people can suffer for a few months, I guess, before.
I don't know.
A crotalid polyvalent immune Fab was associated with better outcomes at 14 days than not giving it. But it's expensive.
Abstract number 13, randomized controlled double-blind trial comparing haloperidol combined with conventional therapy to conventional therapy alone in patients with symptomatic gastroparesis by Rolden in Academic Emergency Medicine 2017. How many times we get this? You get a diabetic patient who's coming in, has vomited 540 times in the past day. And
they have belly pain.
And they have belly pain.
And they're moaning.
And they're feeling awful.
Yeah.
And they tell you that this feels like their gastroparesis.
Yeah. Happens all the time.
Yeah. And so we throw all our antiemetics on them. We give them a bunch of IV fluids. Is there anything else we can give in addition to conventional therapy? Have you used Haldol?
I have used haloperidol for this. It's a great antiemetic. But I haven't seen a lot of evidence, so I'm curious to know what this.
I have had
good anecdotal evidence, so I'm curious to know what this is.
And so in our ED, we do use it here and there, and this gives us some evidence, albeit small amount of evidence. This was a randomized controlled trial of 33 patients. Basically, they randomized them into getting either 5 milligrams of IV Haldol versus getting placebo in addition to conventional therapy that it usually includes metoclopramide or Zofran or your choice of antiemetic with a bunch of IV fluids. And they looked at the outcomes of abdominal pain and nausea as a result of getting Haldol or not.
Did they feel better?
They felt a lot. They did. They felt better, this small cohort. So the patients, like on a visual analog scale, if they got IV Haldol, their visual analog scale of abdominal pain went from 8.5 to 3.1.
Ooh, that sounds pretty significant.
Compared to placebo, 8.3 to 7.2. Not that great. And then the nausea also got significantly better when compared to placebo. So in this small trial, there are some promising results. I think it's a low-risk medication to give in most cases, as long as your QT intervals are okay.
Right.
I think it's low-cost, low-risk, and I think it's worth trying in patients that are pretty freaking miserable when they come in.
Yeah. I mean, the only FDA-approved drug for gastroparesis is metoclopramide. That's the only one. And so, you know, some people end up giving opioids because they got a lot of pain, but it's counterproductive.
That's gastroparesis is delayed gastric emptying.
Right.
And opioids just make that worse.
It turns out that haloperidol also has some purported analgesic mechanism. They think it might kind of work in an MDA kind of way. Mm-hmm. Maybe it's got a little bit of structural similarity to meperidine. So there may be some analgesic effect there as well. But haloperidol is a great antiemetic. I'm not surprised to see that it works. I'm glad to see a little bit of data to support it. So thumbs up from me.
And it's been used in the palliative world for some time.
Yeah.
Now we're just moving it into...
In Chile, they like to use haloperidol for migraines, which is something that we don't use it very often for migraines here. But because of its antiemetic properties, it works pretty well.
Cool. Dopamine antagonist with more power than we thought it had.
Haloperidol was an effective additional agent in gastroparesis.
Abstract number 14, time to appendectomy and risk of complicated appendicitis and adverse outcomes in children in JAMA Pediatrics by Saris et al. From Harvard and Boston Children's. Now, you have to think like a surgeon here, okay? You have to think like a surgeon when you hear about this paper, because in the surgical world, they asked the question, I got a kid with an appy, right lower quadrant pain, positive ultrasound. Does it matter how fast I take the appendix out?
Like I'm getting the phone call at 1 a.m.
Right.
Do I need to come in right now?
Of course. That's really what it boils down to. But the thought about really, you know, getting kids to the OR faster and taking out the appendix faster, why do you do that? You do that because theoretically you're decreasing the chance that they're going to have some complicated course, that they're going to have a rupture or an abscess or something bad happen to them. The faster you get it out, the less you have those complications. That's kind of the theory. But is that really true is the question that they're asking in this study, because we make that assumption, but we're not really sure. So they looked at 2,500 kids, 23 different hospitals, and they wanted to look to see if there's an association between treatment delay and complicated appendicitis. And they looked at basically how fast did they get these appendixes out and then the rate of complicated appendicitis. And what did they find? It was a very happy day for the surgeons when they were able to say that it is unlikely that the timing of the appendectomy affects this risk of complicated disease or adverse outcomes, as long as it's performed within a reasonable time frame. And basically, their conclusion is if you can get the appendix out within 24 hours, you're going to be fine. You're not increasing anybody's risk by waiting in that 24-hour period. And we should just be giving them antibiotics and going to the OR when it's reasonable, when it's staffed, when it's safer for the patient. And by having a little bit of a delay in there and making it more urgent than emergent, you're not actually increasing the risk of complications. What do you think about that, Roman?
I think it's probably a case-by-case thing.
Mm-hmm.
There's some sicker appy patients. There's some not as sick appy patients that you might think would have a safer operation if they waited a few hours.
Yeah.
There are some others that you obviously see and you're like, oh, no, I'm worried about this kid and I would like the surgeon to see them.
One of the things that they did in this paper was they took out all the kids that got a CT scan, because that actually kind of delays their care and there's reasons for getting CT scans and it biases the surgeon, they say, to know really what the complications are. So they took all those kids out of the study, which makes it sort of an interesting group that you're sort of left with. But the bottom line is that this is evidence to suggest that you don't need to be running up to the OR with your kid with appendicitis. You could give them some antibiotics. You could wait a little while to go to the OR. The surgeon isn't unreasonable to do that. And this evidence suggests that they're not going to increase the rate of complications for the kid if they're not running up to the OR with them.
Yeah. As compared to a 3 a.m. underslept surgeon who's...
Exactly.
Yep, sure.
I do think your statement about individual patients is important. And I do think that really what the decision is based on is the patient in front of you, their clinical status, and the available resources. That really is the trump card in all of these situations.
While the authors suggest that you can delay appendectomy for up to 24 hours without problems, our editors are concerned that in some patients, this might be a problem.
Abstract number 15, the effect of treatment delay on the effectiveness and safety of antifibrinolytics in acute severe hemorrhage, a meta-analysis of individual patient-level data from 40,138 bleeding patients.
Every single last one of them.
Yeah, they counted them all. By Gayat Agron et al. In Lancet, November 2017. This is interesting. So they're talking pretty much they're talking about TXA, tranexamic acid. They're talking about two big trials
that we've talked about on EMA and other places before.
The woman trial and the CRASH II trial.
Right.
So we have either a patient who comes in from a bad trauma and is bleeding. They have a tourniquet on. They're bleeding all over the place. Or we have some woman who comes in postpartum, hemorrhaging, and comes to your ED. Doesn't matter how much time we delay in giving the TXA. And the answer?
Of course it matters.
Oh, yeah, and of course you're right. So this study basically looked at these two large trials, and they looked at sort of like the relationship between the timing and the mortality. And it turns out that every 15 minutes of delay in both of these trials that we waited to give the TXA, that translated into a 10% decrease in mortality benefit. And that went all the way into up to 3 hours. And after 3 hours, there really wasn't much of a benefit. They also sort of looked at the primary safety outcome, which was vaso-occlusive events, and the delay or lack of delay of TXA being given didn't affect the rates of vaso-occlusive fatal events. So bottom line here, if you have somebody who's bleeding really bad and you're planning on giving them an antifibrinolytic like TXA, give it early.
The sooner the better. Yeah, I like one of the things they said in this paper is they said, you know, you should think of TXA as an intervention to prevent rather than to treat coagulopathy, because if you give it early, it basically protects your fibrinogen stores and maintains the ability for you to form a stable clot. And so the earlier you give it, the better. And so I think that makes a lot of intuitive sense to me. There are a bunch of ongoing trials right now still looking at TXA, so we'll get more data
for all sorts of indications,
for all kinds of things. But this is 40,000 patients, big power here. And I think it's an important conclusion. The longer you delay, the less bang for your buck you're getting.
Yeah. And again, I think we go back. This is a low-risk, low-cost medication to give early on.
If you're going to give
I'm all about it.
Give it up front.
Delays of more than a few hours when it comes to tranexamic acid results in a significant reduction in its efficacy.
Abstract number 16, application of two risk stratification scores to identify low-risk febrile neutropenic patients in the ED. This is from Annals of Emergency Medicine by Chris Coyne
et al.
From UCSD. Shout out to Chris Coyne and all of his co-investigators. Great paper. So, you know, when you're seeing patients in the ED who've got neutropenic fever, your cancer patient, you got your 50-year-old lady, chemo patient, breast cancer, she comes in, she's got a fever, but otherwise she looks great.
Mm-hmm.
She's not dehydrated. She doesn't have a bunch of comorbidities. She's got good follow-up. She's all plugged in. Do you have to admit her to the hospital?
It sounds like heresy, right? To send home a neutropenic fever.
Yeah.
And it turns out there are some patients that may do okay.
Which makes
but
sense.
Do we know?
Right.
For sure.
So, you know, in the oncology world, they have developed these risk stratification scores that were derived in oncology clinics and inpatient settings to basically give you a bunch of risk factors that will help you identify the low-risk patient that you could reasonably treat in an outpatient setting safely with good follow-up, and helps you make those decisions. We don't we don't apply those in the ED. They weren't derived.
Definitely not at county where we have the follow-up isn't fantastic.
Well, follow-up not being fantastic is certainly a problem. But if let's just say you're working in a place where you do have good follow-up and you could potentially use one of these scores, we don't use them because they have not been derived in ED populations. They're not looking at ED patients when they came up with these risk stratification tools. So Chris Coyne and his co-authors here did a retrospective study looking at a bunch of patients who fall into these categories. Now, these patients all got admitted. They were treated the standard way that we do, but they kind of looked at their hospital course and said, you know, if we had used these scores, could we have identified a low-risk group of people? And maybe in the future, we could study this and see if we could do it. And they looked at 230 patients, and indeed, it looked like one of the scores in particular, the CISNE score, the C-I-S-N-E. Basically, if you use that score, and what's in that score, it's things like comorbidities, it's things like how sick they are, it's things like their age, it's a bunch of lists of things.
To care for themselves, yeah.
Yeah, you're not going to remember all those things. But there is a score called the CISNE score, which actually looks like it might help identify a low-risk group of people, and maybe we could use this in the ED. And so obviously it sets themselves up, the investigators, for future work to actually prospectively look at patients and see if they can identify and prove that these scores can be applied
to
patients.
They generate a nice
ED.
Hypothesis about its use. Yep.
That's right. It's a nice hypothesis generating paper. And I think it's important to know and remind ourselves, because when you read about neutropenic fever, you do see mention of these scores a lot. But remember that they were not derived in an ED population. So they really technically shouldn't be used in an ED population. And so these authors are hopefully going to set the stage for showing us whether or not we can, and that'd be nice to have.
Looking forward to seeing the results.
In this review, the CISNE score outperformed the MASCC score for sending home low-risk neutropenic patients.
Abstract number 17, the clavicle trial, a multi-center randomized controlled trial comparing operative with non-operative treatment of displaced mid-shaft clavicle fractures by Ahrens in the Journal of Bone and Joint Surgery of America, August 2017. This is an interesting article. We see mid-shaft clavicle fractures all the time.
Yep.
They're talking about whether a patient with a displaced mid-shaft clavicle fracture could benefit from surgery rather than just getting thrown in a sling and doing some active range of motion exercises over time.
Right.
So we're used to 80% of mid-clavicle fractures are mid-shaft. So this is super pertinent, and it helps us to answer the question of whether we can just sling them and send them to the PMD or whether we should get these patients ortho follow-up
help
decide whether or not they need surgery. So the results are interesting. Let me talk about their conclusions first, and then we'll kind of backtrack and talk about whether we agree or not with their conclusions. The conclusion here is that the authors feel that patients with displaced mid-shaft clavicle fracture should be managed surgically given surgery safety, better functional outcomes at 3 months, and a lower rate of non-union at 9 months when compared to non-operative management. Sounds good?
Hmm.
But I think we got to dig a little bit deeper.
Yeah.
So in terms of non-union, the way they looked at non-union in these patients, whether they got operative repair or non, was by X-ray. So they found that at 3 months, there was really no difference in non-union. But at 9 months, on the X-ray, if you got operative repair, it looked better.
Okay.
So they had almost 10 times rate of improved non-union on X-ray at 9 months. Hmm. However, when they looked at the patient-oriented outcomes, the function of the patients in terms of their upper limb function by using some validated scores, if you got operative repair at 3 months, they were doing better. But all of that kind of equalized at 9 months where both groups are doing the same.
So it didn't matter. At 9 months, your function was the same whether you got the sling or you went to the
But OR. You looked better on X-ray.
But you looked better on X-ray. But who cares?
The authors care. They say that you should get operative repair so you could look better on X-ray.
Okay. Well, good for you, authors, but I don't really care what the X-ray looks like. I want my arm to work. Does my arm work? Then good.
Your arm works just fine. You may have a little deformity. So, I guess there's something to be said about some shared decision-making with the surgeon if there's a gross deformity or something in there that you want to get fixed. But their conclusions are a little interesting in that the radiologic appearance looks great, functional. Everything is about the same. It's a wash to me.
The outcomes were good in both groups.
Yeah,
and,
they did fine.
You know, they one of the other things they put in their paper is they just think it should be offered to everybody.
Right.
You should offer them. You should explain these results and explain to them that your X-ray will look better at 9 months if we do the surgery. And so, therefore, we should offer it to you. But they also have to explain that your limb function is the
same. It's probably going to be the same.
It's probably going to be the same.
Yep.
So that's kind of a bogus conclusion.
Next.
In this study done by orthopedic surgeons, they suggest that operative management of displaced mid-shaft clavicle fractures was better than non-operative management. The key word there is displaced.
Abstract number 18. Along the ortho lines here, which immobilization is better for distal radius fracture? A prospective randomized trial, but in the Journal of International Orthopedics by Gamba et al. From Barcelona, Spain. When you put a person with a distal radius fracture in a cast, do you go below elbow or above the elbow? What do you do?
Having had a wife who just recently broke her arm on the slopes and got put in a long arm, and then got transitioned into a short arm.
Yeah.
I know she was a lot happier when she had the short arm, but I would want to know if her function would be okay.
Good question. So these Spanish authors, they took adults over age 55 with distal radius fractures, and they randomized them to get the above elbow cast, the less comfortable, to the below elbow, much more comfortable cast. And their aim wasn't actually at function or comfort. They were looking at was the reduction that they did in the ED maintained, and was there an advantage to one type of cast over the other in terms of maintaining the reduction.
Which means that whether or not they would need an operation down the line. If they maintained the reduction, then they probably wouldn't need operative repair.
Now, this is a tiny study. They only have have about 30 to 40 patients in each group, and their conclusion was that it didn't matter which type of cast you used. There was neither one of them offered an advantage over the other in terms of maintaining the position after the reduction. So in the end here, this is a little paper that says it doesn't matter if you put the long arm and the short arm on. They both have as good a chance as the other one of maintaining the reduction.
Put the more comfortable one on.
Now, they do say when they look at their little subgroup analysis, and this gets bogus because the groups are too small, but they do say in one of the subgroups that, you know, it looks like it was a little bit better in terms of the below arm cast versus the other one. I'm just not even going to go into it because I don't think that's fair with these tiny little numbers. But they basically say their conclusion is doesn't matter. So give them the more comfortable one.
Yep, I agree with that. And, you know, I talked to a lot of our hand surgeons over at USC after my wife Lala broke her arm. And it's interesting. Some of the older school hand surgeons still wanted that long arm. And then as soon as we saw one of the younger ones, he's like, well, I would have never put you in that long arm in the first place. It's awful. Patients hate it. And it doesn't really make a difference.
Some of that data comes from the reason that they do that. There were some original studies looking particularly at scaphoid fractures. And they did cadaver studies where they basically would manipulate them. And they thought that the long arm basically led to less movement of the arms than the below arm, and that there was this, you know, these differences in terms of radial and ulnar movement in the cast. But you know what? Doesn't matter.
Okay. Doesn't matter. Make them comfortable.
In older patients, and indeed maybe in all patients, a below elbow cast might be as good as an above elbow cast for distal radius fractures.
Abstract number 19, lumbar puncture for all febrile infants 29 to 56 days old, a retrospective cohort reassessment study in the Journal of Pediatrics by Scarfoni in August 2007.
Scarfoni.
I feel like I want to believe whatever Scarfoni says.
Yeah,
except
you better.
This study.
Scarfoni sounds like he could come after you, he or she.
With a mob.
It's like Scarface.
All right, so this is a case that we have all the time. 1 month old, comes in, fever in the emergency department. Do we LP them? Do we always LP them? Do we apply some of these like low-risk criteria and try not to LP them? Is there an age at which we're okay LPing them? Like if they're 57 days old, are we okay not LPing?
Can you tell me that I don't have to LP all of them? Is that what you're going to tell me,
please?
Well,
that's what these authors are trying to tell you, that you should feel better not LPing these patients, although I don't think everybody would be in agreement exactly with their conclusions. So this was a retrospective cohort study out of the Toronto Hospital for Sick Children. Shout out, Stuart. 2007 to 14, they looked at 29-day to 56-day-old infants with fevers. They enrolled about 1,200 patients. A lot of them had chronic medical issues because they were at this hospital for sick children. And over the course of 7 years, they found that only one patient that got LP'd in the emergency department had bacterial meningitis. One. And that patient, if you applied the low-risk kind of Philadelphia criteria,
modified
that patient would not have been low-risk.
Mm-hmm.
And then they go on to say, well, there was 40 infants that had contaminants on their lumbar puncture, mostly Staph epidermidis or bacillus species. They also comment on two patients that had E. coli that grew out that looked good and didn't get antibiotics and did fine. I don't know if I would have ever not treated an E. coli positive LP.
Well, but you wouldn't have known about it if you hadn't gotten the LP.
Right. But they called it a contaminant.
Yeah.
I don't. That seems a little.
Yeah. They said the Infectious Disease Service said it was a contaminant.
Yeah. I guess so. And then the other caveat here is that they only counted the LPs that were done in the emergency department. They didn't count the LPs that were done upstairs subsequent to that. They didn't count the patients that got discharged. And they didn't account for culture negative LPs that had antibiotics on board already, which could be some of the sicker patients that we may have empirically treated and had them be culture negative by the time the actual LP was done. So are the rates probably lower now post-vaccine age? Sure.
Yes.
In other studies, the risk is quoted at about 0.2 to 0.4%. These are catastrophic cases when they're missed.
Yeah.
I talked to all of our PZD attendings about this, on whether this would be practice changing for them in any way. And most said that they would still LP their own children if it was theirs, given, you know, the rest of the literature that's out there and the high risk associated with it. Some others said that, well, if they were closer to 56 days and under the perfect circumstances, the kid looks great.
Right, all low risk stuff.
All low risk stuff. The whole family has like some runny nose boogery thing and they all have the same thing. Maybe that patient they wouldn't do it on. But
yeah, so I don't think this is practice changing. I agree, it's not super strong evidence. It does suggest that the rate of bacterial meningitis is low, yeah, especially if you, and I think it's just important to apply this kind of knowledge to a very low risk infant.
Yeah.
Looks really good, yep, doesn't have any medical problems, and the whole list. And this includes lab tests in terms of this modified Philadelphia. This is kids that look clinically well and have unremarkable results for 8 different laboratory studies. So there's some objective measures to also put them in the low risk. Yes, that's correct.
In this retrospective cohort study, they found a group of little kids between the ages of 29 days and 56 days that had a really low risk of meningitis.
Abstract number 20. Payments by U.S. pharmaceutical and medical device manufacturers to U.S. medical journal editors. Retrospective observational study in the BMJ by Liu et al. From Toronto, Canada. This is a cha-ching to medical journal editors out there.
BMJ whistleblowers.
Whew, it always comes down to the money, doesn't it? You know, journal editors are important people. They are often the people who are the initial contact. They are often the people who are the final contact. They get to decide which articles get the top billing and get the editorials and all that stuff. And we have lots of conflict of interest knowledge now about authorship, lots of standards for that. But what about journal editors? Are there standards for that? So now these authors decided to go through the now publicly available data, the CMS data, look at that open payments database and see how much money these journal editors are getting paid from pharmaceutical and device companies. And it is pretty shocking.
Some of the numbers are crazy.
So they looked at basically 52 of the biggest U.S. journals, and they kind of condensed these down into two of the big journals from each of the 26 specialties. Now, some of these journals have 20 to 30 editors. One of the cancer journals got 85 editors. So this was everybody from the editor-in-chief down to the associate editors. And they also asked all these journals, they gave them the opportunity to review the list of all the editors that they were basically going to go onto the database and search for and, you know, decide if that list was accurate or not. And they asked them about what their policies were. So we have some information about that as well. What did they find? About half of the group received payments. The highest was endocrinology, then cardiology, GI, rheumatology, then urology. The 5 largest individual physician editors getting the big bucks were as follows. There was a cardiologist getting $10.9 million. Okay, that sounds nuts. The details behind this are, it turns out, that this person actually founded a private company that was subsequently sold to some international medical device corporation. So there's some more details to that one. But there was an orthopedist editor that was paid $1.3 million and another one $326,000, an endocrinologist editor $500,000, a rheumatologist $350,000. I mean, crazy high numbers.
It's one way to make money on the side in medicine.
Woo. About a third of journals had policies about this, and of those, basically the policy was, well, we just expect the editors to self-disclose their conflict of interest. I mean, they just have to, you know, tell on themselves and just put it on out there themselves. They did note, interestingly, in this BMJ article that Annals of Emergency Medicine published very detailed information about editor relationships to industry. So pat on the back for Annals of Emergency Medicine. They also noted that when you compare what these editors are getting from industry as compared to what the average practicing physician in their own specialty receives on average, the editors are getting more, which is disturbing. But like, you have to kind of think of it relative to kind of what are the rest of the cardiologists getting, right? I mean, like, let's not just look at them by themselves. And they point out policies are nice to have, but it's not just about a policy, people. What do you do about your policy? What is the enforcement? What is the action end of the policy? So the bottom line here is it's not uncommon for journal editors to be receiving money. You got to have policies in place and as well as mechanisms for enforcement. And probably if you're an editor of a journal, you shouldn't really be an editor if you've got a big conflict of interest. And you probably shouldn't have associate editors if they've got big ties to these big companies.
God, yeah. You know, who are the journal editors working for? Are they working for the public to publish truthful research and information? Or are you working with drug and device companies? And it's hard to do both. We know that there's going to be bias available. Drug and device manufacturers are not charitable organizations. They're there to make profit. And it's hard to maintain that mission toward scientific truth when you have these conflicts of interest. It's not impossible. It can be disclosed. But it certainly introduces a bias, and it certainly should be disclosed every single time.
There is a lot of editors of major medical journals that get payments from the pharmaceutical and device manufacturer industry. And that's no bueno.
Abstract number 21. the price may not be right. The value of comparison shopping for prescription drugs by Sanjay Arora in the American Journal of Managed Care, 2017.
Good job, Sanjay et al.
Yeah, this is a super interesting article. Basically, the author's conclusions here are that generic medication drug prices can vary within even a small geographic area, and price shopping can yield considerable cost savings for the uninsured and consumers in high deductible health plans. What they're saying here is that drug prices, depending on where you get them, can be really, really expensive or can be really, really cheap.
Yeah.
Even for the same drug, even within the same zip code.
Yeah.
In the same city.
Crazy differences.
Crazy difference. I had no idea. So they basically looked to measure variations in drug prices across and within zip codes. They looked at Los Angeles specifically. They chose 82 zip codes in the LA County area in 2014. They looked over a month. And they looked specifically at the price of Levaquin and azithromycin because they're usually prescribed for acute conditions. So people wouldn't be as familiar with their prices. And the range of prices for these was incredibly variable. Jen, what do you think the average price is for Levaquin?
For
a 5-day course.
5-day course of Levaquin? I'm going to guess that should be
right.
I would say like $20.
$100.
What?
In LA. The lowest price, $19. The highest price, $229.
You gotta be kidding me.
So depending on where you went, and it's interesting, they looked at the differences between pharmacies as well. Whether you got it from a chain drugstore like Rite Aid, CVS versus an independent pharmacy versus a grocery store versus a big box store like Walmart or Target, there was a huge amount of difference. And they found actually in the Los Angeles area, the cheapest ones were in the independent pharmacies.
Hmm.
And the most expensive were actually at the chain drugstores where you would think that
you'd get a
discount.
Yeah.
But there's no incentive for them really to give a good price because you're going to go there regardless for convenience.
Right.
This was specifically for generic drug medications. And this was the prices that they looked at were also specifically for patients that were paying cash, meaning the patients that are most affected by these prices who are people that are uninsured, or if you have a high deductible plan and it's not met yet, then you'd have to pay out of pocket.
Right.
This is new news to me about the range of variability.
This doesn't surprise me at all that there's this huge range. I didn't expect the range to be quite this dramatic. And I was also surprised, as you mentioned, that it was independent pharmacies that had the lower prices compared to the chain drugstores, where you would think you'd be getting a good deal since it's, you know, such a big buyer of drugs, they would deliver those savings to us lowly consumers. But no, again, we get screwed. So,
and that was on aggregate. There were some independent pharmacies that were really expensive and some were that were a lot cheaper, but on average.
The lack of transparency of drug prices is disturbing. And when you look at this, you realize, you know, how often when you need to go get a medication, do you actually shop around? No, you don't. You just go to wherever is convenient for you. But yet, if you really are interested in saving some money, you probably should shop around. The thing that disturbs me about this is e-prescribing. E-prescribing is a problem because that's pretty much commonplace in a lot of systems
that we call
now.
To a specific pharmacy.
Yeah. Now with EMRs, you put in an e-prescribing, it goes straight to the pharmacy. You basically cut out the patient's ability to shop around if you're e-prescribing and directing it to a pharmacy. So the effect of e-prescribing on people's independence to make choices, I think, is unfortunate.
Yeah, and this affects not only our patients, I talked to Sanjay about this, but a lot of us that could price, you know, shop out our medications. And when I talked to Sanjay, I asked him if there was any message for the audience. He said, where you buy your medication matters. Take that to the bank.
When it comes to prescription drugs, you should shop around. There's wide variations in how much this stuff costs.
Abstract number 22, resolution of cannabis hyperemesis syndrome with topical capsaicin in the ED, a case series. This is in Clinical Toxicology by Desiek et al. From UMass. Back in August of 2017, we did a paper on haloperidol for cannabis hyperemesis. And now here we are looking at topical capsaicin. So, you got that kid back again. We talked about gastroparesis earlier. Now you have this patient that's coming again, abdominal pain, vomiting, gagging himself in triage. Everyone's like, this kid's back again.
Yeah.
You know, what do you give that kid?
Can we slap some capsaicin on his belly?
Can we slap some capsaicin
on?
And why in the world would that work? Now, we do know that patients who have cannabis hyperemesis syndrome, which is the cyclical abdominal pain, the nausea, vomiting, they often get better with the hot showers and the baths, right? And they're often very refractory to common antiemetics. And it turns out that this there's a particular receptor family in the that they think is part of the pathogenesis of cannabis hyperemesis syndrome. And so these authors from Barnes Jewish Hospital in St. Louis and UMass basically show that in this little case series, not the highest level of evidence, but they successfully treated 13 cases with capsaicin cream. And they describe these cases in detail, and they tell you what other medications they got and you know, the different factors. Now, what is cannabis hyperemesis syndrome in terms of a definition? There's three things you got to have. One, long-term marijuana use before your symptoms start. Two, a history of recurrent vomiting. And three, the absence of some other illness that could explain your symptoms. Now, you're thinking to yourself, okay, capsaicin cream, that sounds interesting. How do I do that? Well, you basically smear this cream on their abdomen. Now, you don't have to put it on their abdomen. You could put it on their back or their chest. You just need sort of a nice little wide area to do it. But you know, it works on the abdomen because that's where a lot of the patients are feeling their symptoms. What were the doses that were used? The capsaicin concentration varied. Most cases used the 0.25%, but a couple of the patients got the 0.075%. So a little variation there in terms of the concentration that you use. But let me tell you, they detail these cases, and these are patients who got fluids and sometimes pain medication and antiemetics, and then they get their capsaicin, and they do better, and they get discharged faster. Now, what's the most common side effect of capsaicin cream? What would you guess, Raman?
It hurts.
It burns. And some other common adverse effects, they get a little bit of localized redness, some non-productive cough. The evidence for this is pretty limited. Outside of this little case series of 13 patients, this is the most evidence that we have for this. There was an article in a Spanish language journal that described 7 cases, and there were a few abstracts back in 2014 at the big talks meeting, but this is the level of evidence we have. Have you used it, Raman? Have you heard of this before?
I've seen it done once. One of our residents did it recently. The patient did great.
Yep. Yeah, my experience, happy. I've seen this in about 3 or 4 different cases. I've used it in people who just weren't getting better with the regular stuff, and it works.
Yep.
That's anecdotal. It's case series. I know it's not the highest level, but hey, if nothing else is working, might want to give it a shot. Mm-hmm.
For cannabis hyperemesis syndrome, maybe a little capsaicin rubbed on the tummy helps.
Abstract number 23, the effect of oral prednisolone on symptom duration and severity in non-asthmatic adults with acute lower respiratory tract infection, published in JAMA, August 2017, by Hay et al.
Hey.
All right. So this is, we get our cold season coming up during the winter. It's February. A lot of people are having lower and upper respiratory tract infections. But these patients that have lower respiratory tract infections, where previously a lot of them were getting overprescribed antibiotics, now we're looking in this article to see whether or not given some oral prednisolone will help with either the duration or the severity of their symptoms. What do they define as acute lower respiratory tract infection? They define it as cough plus at least one of the following symptoms. 1, sputum. 2, chest pain. 3, shortness of breath. 4, wheeze. So basically anything cough associated with anything down below.
So it's like a chest cold.
A chest cold. What a perfect way to describe it.
Which you might call acute bronchitis, too.
Like an adult version of
bronchitis. Let's just call it a chest cold, okay?
And these guys, do you prescribe prednisone to your chest colds?
You know, I don't, but I understand the theory of it is that this prednisolone might be useful because it's kind of like asthma. The pathophysiology of it might be similar to asthma. You get a little reactive airway. You get some goo in your bronchioles. Yeah. And so maybe steroids would make it better, like it does in asthmatics, a short course. So it's tempting to think it might work. Does it work?
Well, it's worth experimenting. So multi-center placebo-controlled randomized controlled trial in England at 54 family practices. This was not an ED setting. They randomized about 400 adults with lower respiratory tract infections, and they found that it made no difference. Neither severity of symptoms nor duration of symptoms, and their conclusion is don't use it if you don't need to. I have seen some patients, this is sort of anecdotally, if I can even think of a time where sometimes people give patients steroids, if they have that cough and then they have that long, prolonged sort of post-viral cough that won't go away.
Mm-hmm.
I've seen that prescribed. I don't know if that works. That's not really specifically addressed in this study. But in general, for all comers with lower respiratory tract infections, no prednisolone.
Yeah. And remember, they excluded people with asthma. So in terms of what the wheeze component, if they do have asthma, that's a different population. That's an asthma exacerbation. Steroids still work there. But in just the cough plus one of the, you know, cold type symptoms, you're not going to get much benefit from the steroids.
So we're back. Vitamin C, T, rest, your home remedy of choice.
Yeah. Chicken soup.
Chicken soup.
I don't know.
In non-asthmatic patients, basically with bronchitis, steroids didn't reduce the duration of the symptoms.
Abstract number 24, effect of nebulized hypertonic saline treatment in emergency departments on the hospitalization rate for acute bronchiolitis. This is in JAMA Pediatrics by Abgulevent and about 100 other authors for the GRAND study group. This is a group studying the efficacy of 3% nebulized hypertonic saline in acute viral bronchiolitis. This lead author is from Paris. So when you see the little kid with the coughing, the wheezing, you're in bronchiolitis season, you've admitted three of them in the last week. Does anything work in these kids?
Conservative treatment, sucking out their boogers.
Yeah. So you got some, you know, respiratory support, a little bit of oxygen. How about some hypertonic saline? Does it work? Hypertonic saline treatment in acute bronchiolitis? The answer is no. A difference in admission rate between the two treatment groups was not seen. There was a trend towards reduction in respiratory distress in the short term, but it did not prevent hospital admission. This was a big multi-center trial, 24 French pediatric EDs over two bronchiolitis seasons. They randomized these infants who are 6 weeks to 12 months old to either getting 3% nebulized hypertonic saline or nebulized normal saline. They used a jet nebulizer. Otherwise, the kids were kind of treated with whatever the treating provider wanted to try. And they basically looked at, did the admission rate go down? That was their endpoint. They enrolled just over 700 kids. The RSV prevalence was very high. And it turns out it didn't matter. By 24 hours, about half of the hypertonic saline group got admitted and basically the same rate for the normal saline group. So there was no statistical benefit to preventing admission with this therapy. Now, this was kind of the middle of the road bronchiolitis patients. They couldn't be too sick. They couldn't be too mild. So you could say, well, maybe it works in one of those groups. But I don't think it works for these bronchiolitis kids. This hypertonic saline didn't really work. And, you know, the idea of using it was like, you know, maybe it'll help sort of decrease the mucus plugging and reduce the airway edema. And it just doesn't work. It's a bummer because there's just like nothing that works for this thing. And here's yet another thing that doesn't work. So
one day we'll find something that works.
Yeah.
Or maybe not.
Nope.
In this study, nebulized hypertonic saline did not help bronchiolitic patients.
Abstract number 25, IV magnesium sulfate for bronchiolitis, published in Chest 2017 by Alan Sari et al. This is a Qatari paper. We just talked about hypertonic saline not really working for bronchiolitis. Let's talk about something else that doesn't work for bronchiolitis.
Yeah.
Bottom line here is that IV mag in this trial didn't provide any benefit for acute pediatric bronchiolitis and may actually cause harm. So these authors look back at studies showing that nebulized mag and bronchiolitis didn't really have an effect. So why not try to study IV mag and see if that works? They did a randomized controlled trial, 160 about previously healthy infants. They gave them 100 milligrams per kilogram of IV mag versus placebo. Over 3 years, they did this study, and they found that really there was no difference in meaningful outcomes. What they actually studied was their time for readiness to discharge. That was their primary outcome. So they found no difference there. They also looked at the bronchiolitis severity score and the need for hospital admission and clinic revisits within 2 weeks. None of those were really significant in terms of difference. The only one that was significant in the group that got IV mag, 20% of them were readmitted to the hospital or the infirmary within 2 weeks. Whereas in the placebo group, only 6% came back for revisits.
Nah, so it can't be due to the mag. There's, you know, this paper is weird. It's got a lot of background noise going
there's
on.
There's a lot of, yeah. What the signal in the noise.
Yeah.
A lot of these, some patients got hypertonic. Some of them got Dex.
Yes.
Some of them got other stuff. They didn't really control for other variables here.
Correct.
So it's really hard to make conclusions. But they weren't able to find a difference with this sort of flawed methodology that they used.
Correct.
In this study, nebulized magnesium did not help bronchiolitic patients.
Abstract number 26, small tube thoracostomy in emergent management of chest trauma in the journal Injury by Tanizaki et al. From Fukui, Japan. They're looking at tiny tubes here, 20 to 22 French, in people that need chest tubes for hemothorax. So when you see a patient, Ramen,
yeah.
Motorcycle accident, you know, crepitus in the chest, you think there's blood in there,
yeah.
And you're going to put a chest tube in, what size do you choose?
Jeez, I remember when we were in residency, we were taught to use like 36s, 30, mm-hmm. The big boy tubes.
Right.
And I know that's been sort of shown to be not as effective. So right now I'm using 28s, 30s.
Okay.
I haven't even thought about 20s and 22s. It sounds like a really big Foley size.
Yeah. So these Japanese authors conclude that a small chest tube, 20 to 22 French, is basically fine. It's just the same as a larger tube. And to them, a large tube was 28 French.
Sounds really small.
Sounds really small. They didn't find any association between tube size and tube-related complications. That was kind of their outcome. Although their findings are a little limited because it's small sample size. They didn't randomize people to different sizes of tubes. But what they did do is they did basically a seven-year review of patients who got chest tubes. Now, remember, back in 2012, our good friend Kenji Inaba et al. Published on this topic, and they found that tube size didn't affect outcomes. So they looked at 36-40 French, the big boy tube, versus 28-32 French, and there was no difference between those sizes. And now we're going down here to 20-22 French, 20-22. You know, there also are those tubes that are available for pneumothorax and perhaps even other indications beyond that in the 10-14 French, like the ones that are in the kits with the Seldinger, you know, Seldinger technique. So they basically wanted to look at tube-related complications, and they had 116 patients over 7 years. That's about 16 patients a year. And these were all patients with blunt trauma for the most part, very, very few penetrating. Their mortality in this group was very low, so only 3% overall. And a little more than half of the tubes in these patients were small, the 20 to 22 French. A little less than half were the big ones, 28 French. And so these are kind of small groups. There's about 50, 60 patients in the groups. Really no differences between the patients in terms of what kind of injuries they had, what they looked like. The larger tube group had a little bit longer ICU stayed, but otherwise there were really no differences in complications. Now, this is a retrospective thing, so this is not a controlled randomized trial, and we don't have data that are a little bit more patient-oriented in the sense of like the pain of insertion or how did it feel as they were in the hospital. They had these tubes in for about a week, so we don't know those differences. I think there's also a difference, frankly, between the Japanese person and the average American. I mean, obviously our skeletons are essentially the same, the bones, but the soft tissues between those groups are not necessarily
the same. Our diets are not exactly.
So, you know, in terms of these tubes practically working in your average American, and do they kink and are they really going to be effective for that sick person with a hemothorax? I'm not sure that the external validity is there. The extrapolation in my mind, just in terms of a common sense check, not so sure, but interesting.
Yep.
In hemothoraces from a variety of causes, small tubes, 20 to 22 French, work just as well as the bigger 28 French.
Abstract number 27, testing for respiratory viruses in children, to swab or not to swab. Published in JAMA Pediatrics, August 2017 by Gill and colleagues. The authors basically conclude here that it's not necessary to do viral testing in patients where the diagnosis can be made clinically. If it looks like a virus and smells like a virus, we don't really need to be doing viral testing. It's expensive and likely does not contribute to the patient's treatment. So this review article basically explores the rationale behind ordering these viral tests and then talks about a few cases where you might consider it. But in general, they conclude that it's not necessary. So the most commonly cited reason we use to do these viral tests is to reduce additional investigations. And in the primary care setting, there has been some literature to show that rapid influenza testing may decrease lab testing and chest radiography. But in clinicians who use rapid testing, it's been found that they have higher rates of ordering labs and radiographs, presumably when they find a negative test. And there's no evidence to show that positive viral tests decreases the amount of antibiotic treatment, especially in light of that more than 50% of kids that end up having community-acquired pneumonia also test positive for respiratory viruses.
Right.
So maybe the reason we're doing this is the physician's need for a diagnosis, that we need to have an answer.
Right. Diagnostic uncertainty.
What's that? Yeah, to get it. Yeah, exactly. So we are diagnosing you with RSV confirmed bronchiolitis. And so they do mention MDs vary in their comfort level with diagnostic tests. They do talk about a few instances where you may consider viral testing. So I'm just going to go through those. The first one is in pandemic situations. They allude to the severe acute respiratory syndrome pandemic of 2003, where you want to kind of isolate and control the contagion. Number two, critically ill patients. In patients like a really, really sick RSV patient where you may be considering ribavirin. Thank you. English is a second language. Another time you may consider it is influenza testing for at-risk influenza patients who are immunocompromised, premature, sickle cell patients. And lastly, febrile patients, infants less than 3 months who have negative bacterial cultures and a positive viral test may help with some antiviral biotic stewardship. But outside of that, the bottom line here that the author stresses that immunocompetent kids with typical viral respiratory tract infections, we don't need to be swabbing.
It's a clinical diagnosis. You know, these are relatively new in terms of the average clinician being able to access these. With the advent of PCR and this technology getting cheaper, we have these available. But just because we can doesn't mean we should. And so, yes, I think people are, you know, playing with these tests and ordering them, and I agree it helps reduce diagnostic uncertainty. But the truth is, these are clinical diagnoses. There are a few specific circumstances where it might benefit you. But just because you have the test doesn't mean you should be ordering the test.
Agreed.
In general, routine swabbing for viruses in febrile kids is a waste of time, but it might be good in specific immune-compromised children.
Abstract number 28. How accurate is rapid antigen testing for group A strep in children with pharyngitis? This is from Annals of EM. This is one of their systematic review snapshot series, a little two-pager with a take-home message by Ganti and Ballinger from University of Central Florida in Orlando. You know, you got that patient, you got the five-year-old, sore throat, no cough, little fever, a little yucky-looking throat. Do you do the rapid antigen test before you give the antibiotics? Do you just treat? How do you decide? What do you do, Raman?
Maybe a little risk stratification, Centaur score. If it's really, really high, I tend to just give the antibiotics. If it's low, then I don't get the test. I know it's not completely in line with all the guidelines, but...
Yeah. So their take-home message is that children with negative results on rapid antigen testing may be discharged without antibiotics or any further testing. You get a negative swab, it's a pretty good test. Don't give them the antibiotics if that's what you need to use to decide. So you mentioned the Centaur criteria, and I think that's an important thing. There are clinical decision tools that we have to help us make decisions about who to treat. And so the Centaur score is worth reviewing for a moment because it's really useful, and it should be part of your decision-making. Basically, the recommendation from the Centaur score these days is the IDSA doesn't really want us empirically treating anybody. They want us to actually pick and choose and not necessarily empirically treat. And so they say that you should test if two of the following are present. You either have fever, tonsillar exudator swelling, swollen tender anterior lymphadenopathy, absence of cough. If you only have zero or one, no test. Basically, we used to say that if you have all four, you should empirically treat, but the official recommendations are to test. Now, the IDSA goes even one step further, which is to say if the test is negative, you should probably still send a culture, which I think is crazy, and I'm not going to... It's a lot of extra steps. And the authors, even although they mention it in their manuscript, in their take-home capsule, they say just discharge them, no further testing. What I would say is when it comes to pharyngitis, don't forget also about steroids and pain meds and kind of that symptomatic treatment.
Absolutely.
And the fact that why are we even testing them at all is worth a mention as well. We used to think that we were testing them to decrease the suppurative and the non-suppurative complications. And really those non-suppurative complications, the rheumatic fever, for example, in the developed world is really decreasing the incidence of that. And so that's becoming sort of a non-indication. There's controversy about whether antibiotic treatment actually decreases the suppurative complications at all. And maybe that doesn't even. So the question is, do you decrease secondary transmission or maybe make the patient feel a little better, a little faster? And that's probably
symptom
the primary
control.
Reason that right. we treat with antibiotics in terms of making that decision. So the test is good. If it's part of your clinical decision-making routine, it performs just fine. If it's negative, you can discharge them without any antibiotics or any further testing.
In pediatric pharyngitis, rapid strep testing is pretty good. It misses, though, about 5% of kids who are culture positive for strep.
Abstract number 29, predictive utility of the total Glasgow Coma Scale versus the motor component of the Glasgow Coma Scale for identification of patients with serious traumatic injuries, published in Annals of Emergency Medicine, August 2017 by Chow et al. Basically, the authors here are looking at the total GCS score versus just a modified using only motor GCS score in the field triage of patients to decide whether or not they need to go to a trauma center or not, and to make things easier on our EMS providers. So they do a systematic review looking at the predictive value of using the total GCS versus a motor GCS, and then they even have this other like simplified motor scale that's even easier to use than the motor GCS. I'm not going to bore you with all the actual numbers, but their bottom line here is that the total GCS is associated with slightly greater discriminative value than using the motor GCS alone in identifying severe trauma. And they say that, you know, these small differences in discrimination are likely clinically important and could be offset by factors such as convenience and ease of use. So if you're looking at this from an EMS provider's perspective, why do I have to do the entire GCS if I could just do the motor and it could help me predict like whether or not this patient's a bad trauma? I don't know.
Yeah, I mean, like the idea that you're just going to look at the motor GCS is trying to keep it simple,
right.
Trying to keep it simple for field personnel. And if that's good enough, let's just do that. Let's just do the motor score and not the total GCS. Mm-hmm. But it turns out that the total GCS is probably in a few patients, it's going to
they
be
say it's a
more
little
valuable.
You'll identify mm-hmm. some patients. Nothing compelling here for us to recommend doing a modified GCS at this point.
Just using the motor score appears to be at least as good, maybe better than the entire Glasgow Coma score in terms of predicting outcomes in trauma patients.
Abstract number 30, patient outcomes at urban and suburban level 1 versus level 2 trauma centers. This is from Annals of Emergency Medicine by Amy Kaji et al., our friends at Harbor UCLA. And so does it matter? Does it matter if you're a trauma patient if they take you to a level 1 or a level 2 center? That's kind of the patient question. And so what's the difference between level 1 and level 2 centers? These are American College of Surgeons designations. What's the difference?
Yeah, this is a board exam question they ask all the time. Research...
Level one places have research.
Yep.
Mm-hmm. What else?
They have other specialists available.
Yeah, they have a bunch of different specialists available, specifically orthopedics. You got to be fellowship trained in trauma.
Yep.
You got to have 24-hour availability of certain equipment. You got to have an injury prevention coordinator. You got to have a substance abuse screening and intervention program. But really, those are the differences between level one and level two.
The core services are essentially the same.
Does it matter in terms of patient outcomes? This has been studied. The results have varied. The authors in this study are going to tell you that bottom line is that as they look at their database is that it seems like level one doesn't mean better, that you actually do a little better when you go to a level two, which is interesting. In previous studies, and these papers are in the EMA database, there was a study in 2009 from Ohio that said patients that go to level one trauma centers do better. There was another study from 2005 that looked at head injured patients in Oregon and Washington and said that they seem to do better when you go to a level one. So these authors looked in LA County and they looked at patients that went to level one versus level twos. And in here in LA County, we have 14 different trauma centers. There's 5 that are level ones and 9 that are level twos. And this is all database work. All of these hospitals maintain trauma-based databases, and they ended up with like 64,000 patients, and almost half and half went to level ones and level twos. And when they looked at the overall mortality rates between the different centers, it looked like when you adjusted for risk and you actually adjusted for what was your kind of mortality risk overall, there were lower mortality odds for the level two centers versus the level one centers. Now, it didn't seem to apply to penetrating trauma patients, just the blunt ones. And so, you know, bottom line in terms of methodologic comment, this is a chart review. You can only kind of show these associations. You can't control for the provider workup decisions and that kind of thing that happens in the real life scenario. But when you look at this big database, it looked like if you went to level two, you had a slightly lower mortality rate than when you went to a level one, when you adjust for the mortality risks itself. If you look at the raw data, it didn't matter. But when you did these important adjustments, it looked like it mattered a little bit.
Yeah.
But what do you think?
I think that if I got hit by a car or stabbed or shot, I would want to go to the closest place.
Right.
And get treated.
Yeah. So I think what it tells me is that in terms of how patients do, probably doesn't matter that much between the two, which isn't that much of a surprise when you really kind of step back and look at it.
In this study, level two trauma centers were better than level one trauma centers in terms of outcome. But this is an ongoing debate.
Abstract 1 is a French consensus guideline on the scary phenomena of acute angioedema. Basically, Mel, they remind us that there's two types of angioedema. There's the bradykinin-mediated, which is the slow one. It runs a 2 to 3 day course. The ACE inhibitor one as well is in that category. And then there's the histamine-mediated one, which is an allergic sort of phenomena with a trigger. It's fast, and it has hives. And just to remind everyone, you treat that with epinephrine and antihistamines, whereas you treat the bradykinin-mediated one with other things, but they're recommending things that we think probably don't work, like icatibant and you know.
Can't work. Get the can't work. Got it. All right. Abstract 2 is about coronary, trying to determine if somebody's got ACS. Yes, you can use history and physical to roughly divide people into high risk and low risk using all of those things you learned in medical school, but it is not sufficient. You do have to go further and do EKGs and other things like troponins.
Yes, exactly. Abstract number 3 is a prospective observational study from Finland, which talks about the Lazarus phenomena.
Hello.
Like coming back to life.
Oopsie.
So they found that actually in 6 out of 1,000 patients, after they stopped CPR and they pronounced, they found that 6 out of 1,000 came back to life.
That's a lot.
So, but the good news is it mostly occurred very soon after, within 3 to 8 minutes. So these guys recommend maybe wait 10 minutes after you after you stop CPR until you pronounce.
Yeah, I like to wait like 6 to 8 months just to be sure.
Just to be just totally to be sure. Sure.
Abstract 4 is about angiotensin 2 infusions. It's from the New England Journal for Vasodilatory Shock, so basically for mostly septic shock. Did it do anything in addition to your usual care with some fluids and some other things that raise your blood pressure? And the answer, short answer, is no. Mortality was no difference, despite the fact they tried really hard to find differences. You're still dying.
Yeah, that's too bad. Abstract number 5 is a small but important New England Journal study from Utah that suggests, this is a relief actually, Mel, that PE is not a huge cause of unexplained syncope. The rate of PE as a cause of syncope was like 1.4%.
Yes.
It's a big relief to hear after that alarming PESIT study from Italy a couple years ago that said that like everyone that had syncope had PE. So probably a little more realistic for real life.
That PESIT study was trying to suggest that occult PEs are all over the place. This study says no. If it looks like a PE, it's probably a PE. But don't worry, it's not that occult. Abstract 6 is a validation of the Ottawa subarachnoid rule. So this is their validation set, and they said our subarachnoid rule works.
So this is great. I think this is great. We've been waiting for this for a long time, and it's prospective and it's validated. But in my view, the real reason that this works is because of the thunderclap headache criteria.
Right.
You know, for years and years, I think it took us a long time to realize, hey, it's not just the worst headache of your life. It's got to be sudden. It's got to be maximal at onset. And then when you apply that within this rule, it starts performing really well.
I want to change one thing. I would call it a guideline, not a rule. I don't like rules.
Yeah.
It's a good guideline.
Abstract 7 is a psychiatric study that looks at suicide risk in patients that engage in a self-harm episode. Now, I think this is something that most of us had always thought, which is that the more violent the means of self-harm, the more risky it is for future episodes. And so that's what they found. Like if you take a gun and you hurt yourself, it's more likely you're going to actually kill yourself and that it will happen soon, like within a month.
So you put this into your algorithm of trying to decide this person's risk, which we know is very hard, but this is one thing that is a predictor. Abstract 8 is about an analysis of emergency department length of stay for mental health patients, and no surprise, in Massachusetts, as in the rest of the country, mental health patients have extraordinarily long waiting times to find an inpatient bed, especially if they're poor and underinsured.
They continue to get the short end of the stick. Does a stick have ends, actually? They're short and long. Did I say that right? The short end of the stick? Short end of the stick, is it?
It's the saying.
Yeah, this is the time to revisit our idioms. Okay. Abstract 9 looks at pre-hospital stroke triage. As you know, Mel, the American Heart Association recommends transporting stroke patients to a comprehensive stroke center if it doesn't add more than 15 minutes to the trip. Well, that's what they found. In this Cincinnati-based study, they showed that going to a comprehensive stroke center would add about 8 minutes on average to the transport. So it's doable. But, of course, what the consequences of that are is that the case volume would increase by massive amounts. I think they calculated 359%. So the question is, you know, could that caseload be accommodated, right? That's the other question.
Here they come. The strokes are coming.
Yep.
Abstract 10 is the upgoing thumb sign, a sensitive indicator for brain involvement. So this is a really, to me, a brand new sign. So you get them to flex their arms, and you have to look at the YouTube video. But if their thumb pops up when they start flexing their arms at the elbow, then they're saying, hey, thumbs up. I've had a TIA or a stroke, mate.
Yeah, and bottom line is it's kind of like doing a Babinski sign or plantar reflex without the pain and without the inconvenience of that. So I love this thing. And the author, Hutchinski, is like a national hero in Canada. He's a major stroke researcher in Canada. He's got a lot of funding from the state. So I like that, too.
It's a new little sign to add to your armamentarium. Pretty fun.
Abstract 11, Melvis, is a study that shows how the implementation of the Medicaid expansion, you know, that was part of the Affordable Care Act, the Medicaid expansion.
Yes.
And that was in 2014. It resulted in greater ER visits in the states that adopted the Medicaid expansion. So in states that insured lots more of their lower-income people, they saw a rise in their number of visits to the ED as compared to those states that didn't expand their Medicaid rolls. So this is something that we obviously lived through in California, and it kind of makes sense, right? Because there wasn't that many primary care doctors, and so a lot of people were coming to the ER over the past few years.
That's correct. Abstract 12 is about the use of a Crofab agent for copperhead snake envenomation, a randomized double-blind placebo-controlled trial that said at about 14 days, if you got the Crofab stuff, you were doing a little bit better functionally than if you weren't. But just remember the downsides. It's really expensive.
Yeah, like they say that you start with 6 vials and it's $2,300 a vial.
It's a lot.
That's a lot of money, but...
It's a lot. Do you have a criteria for when you give and don't give? You don't give it to everybody with a history, obviously.
But... Right, yeah. No, I think you have to see stuff, you know, and I think there has to be some threshold there. Especially copperheads are less life-threatening than the ones we have out here.
And compared to Australia, mate, they're wimps.
Exactly. Abstract number 13 is a study from the MD Anderson Cancer Center in Texas, and it's great. It shows that the addition of 5 milligrams of IV haloperidol to whatever standard pain and nausea treatment they're giving was safe, and it worked.
Abstract 14, time to appendectomy, from JAMA Pediatrics. This purports to suggest that it doesn't matter when you take the appendix out. They come in, they got appendicitis. It's all good, bro. I'm going to start. I've got a big weekend planned. I'm going to come in on Tuesday, and we'll take that thing
out.
Are
you suggesting that the surgeon has an accent?
Yeah.
Okay.
But you got to be a little bit careful of this. I think Raman said it best. You have to stratify your appendicitis patients. There are some where it's like, I don't know if they've even got it. Some patients can go home on antibiotics, and others need the damn thing taken out. So this is a little bit dangerous to suggest overall you can wait a day.
Well, I really think so. You know, we don't need another association study to show us that it's safe to delay surgery for anything like appendicitis. We need randomized control trials for that, because obviously there's a difference in the populations of the one that you decided to urgently operate on and those that you didn't.
Yep.
And so I'm not convinced that this is the way to go. Abstract number 15 is a study in The Lancet that analyzed all the patients in those massive tranexamic acid TXA studies, the CRASH II study that looked at trauma and the woman study that looked at postpartum hemorrhage. And it concluded something again that I think we already were thinking, which is that the sooner you give the TXA, the better the outcomes, the better that you're able to stop bleeding. In fact, for every 15 minutes that you delay in giving the TXA, that rhymes, there's a 10% decrement in outcome. So after 3 hours, there's no benefit. And that's sort of what we've been saying.
And after they've bled to death, it's absolutely no effect.
It has little effect.
Abstract 16 is about neutropenic fever and whether you can send some of these patients home and which scoring system you should use. And you should know about this because there is a trend with neutropenic fever and with neutropenia in general to be doing less in certain subsets of populations. So know that there are these scoring systems that your oncologist, your hematologist might occasionally send some people home. Don't freak the heck out. There might be some science behind this.
And did you notice that's Chris Coyne who wrote that paper? That's Chris Coyne. He's the senior author on that.
What?
Our own Chris Coyne in Annals. That's awesome. He's doing great down there. He's in San Diego, right? Abstract 17 is an actual randomized study of open reduction versus non-op management for displaced mid-shaft clavicle fractures. And the authors conclude, what do you think they conclude, Mel?
That open reduction's better.
That you should operate on everyone.
Everybody.
But I think...
Payments for the Beamer.
Right. But I think that, you know, we've been doing this a while, and I think that if you read the paper, you'll see there's all kinds of problems with their outcomes and their methods, and I'm definitely not convinced of this. I think that operative management is still quite an option in some cases.
Abstract 18 is about whether you need to immobilize above the elbow or below the elbow for distal radius fractures. It's a small Spanish study that suggests that below the elbow is sufficient for the vast majority of people. It is small. I'd like to see some more stuff because, boy, would patients love it if we stopped immobilizing their entire arm.
I love this stuff. And, you know, as you get older, it doesn't take long for an elbow to completely freeze, right? So this would be really good if we can do it this way. Abstract 19 is a study in pediatrics that looks at whether LP is really necessary in well-appearing febrile children that are in that controversial window. Mm-hmm. You know, they're not in the first month. They're 29 days to 56 days, you know, 1 to 2 months. And they found a vanishingly low rate of meningitis, like one case. And so this calls into question the routine need for LP in this patient population. As, you know, they point out, the LP itself is not risk-free. And when they use the modified Philadelphia low-risk criteria, and likely, Mel, a lot of different other scales would work for that, criteria would work for that, it would probably reduce dramatically the number of LPs.
Yeah, and I think you have to do this with the patient's family. It's not a zero-sum game, not a zero risk either way. Let's chat about what we want to do here.
And this is obviously kids that are fully vaccinated and there's no other issues.
Abstract 20 is, to me, the saddest article of the month, which is payments by U.S. pharmaceutical and medical device manufacturers to U.S. medical journal editors, a retrospective study, and basically says that there's a whole bunch of people who are getting paid by device makers and the pharmaceutical industry who are in positions of power and positions that can sort of tweak the way we think about things or what gets published.
They're influence. They're, what do you call them? These are opinion
leaders.
These are
thought leaders. These are influence leaders. Yeah. And if you don't believe that getting money from device manufacturers results in a change of outcome, then you're silly, because there's only one reason that you're paying for this stuff, is for influence. It's the same in politics. This is bad. If you're a journal editor, you should be taking zero money.
Yeah, I only had two words that I wrote down for this, but they're in Yiddish, so I don't know if they translate, but it's oy vey.
Thank you.
Abstract number 21 is a pharmacoeconomic paper.
Say what?
I just wanted to say that. That means how much it costs to buy drugs.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. And it shows basically in the U.S. That you can get good deals if you shop around for your meds.
Yeah.
There's a huge variation. They surveyed a ton of pharmacies and found a gigantic variation in the prices of common drugs.
Yeah, it's true for the street drugs and it's true for the prescription drugs. You should shop around.
That's right.
Get the right dealer.
That's right.
What I'm saying. Abstract 22 is about resolution of cannabis hyperemesis syndrome with a little bit of topical capsaicin. So this worked, apparently. You put a little topical capsaicin on your belly and your cannabis hyperemesis syndrome gets better. There's another thing that works as well.
And that's haloperidol.
No, it's stop smoking
weed. So much weed, yeah. But if the capsaicin for sure, and if you haven't tried the haloperidol, definitely you could try that. It really works for this. Abstract 23 is a British study in JAMA where they tried steroids for patients with cough and lower respiratory tract infection, which is kind of like pneumonia, but it's vague term, so that includes bronchitis and other things. Anyway, what did they find?
It worked.
It does not work.
Oh, it doesn't work.
No. And so, that doesn't include people with asthma.
Right.
Because you still use steroids for that. But in people with a cough and other lower respiratory tract infection symptoms, steroids did not help.
They didn't give you euphoria? Make you happy? No? Nothing? Abstract 24 is the effect of nebulized hypertonic saline in the little kids with bronchiolitis. And guess what? This didn't work either.
Yeah, you can add this to the list of
things that don't work for bronchiolitis.
Oh, but wait. Abstract 25. Yet another paper showing that nothing works in acute bronchiolitis. This time it's a paper in CHEST, and it's a randomized double-blind international study that shows that IV magnesium did not help these patients with acute bronchiolitis, and it may even hurt.
Yeah, that's what's weird. I'm like, mag doesn't hurt anybody except maybe in bronchiolitis. Episode 26 is about small tube thoracostomy, 22 French versus the bigger ones, sort of the 28 French, and they found no difference in people with a range of injuries, and it worked just as well. So we've gone from 40 French to 28 French to 22 French. You know what the next study is going to be?
Not doing the chest tube at all.
Not doing a chest tube at all. Yeah. So even the little tiny ones were working, so I don't know where this is going to go, but small is okay.
Yeah, well, listen, Mel, as you know, you can always go smaller.
Thank you.
Okay. Abstract 27, this is a treatise. This is like a position paper. It's from my alma mater from U of T up in Canada. And it basically beats the crap out of the practice of doing nasopharyngeal swabs on little ones. I would say that if the little kids that didn't like getting those swabs done, because they kind of emphasize how much they don't like, if they were to do a class action lawsuit against the people that subject them to this, they would submit this paper as evidence, because it basically gives you the whole discussion of, you know, what can go wrong with indiscriminate viral testing. However, there are still some patients where it's warranted, patients that are immunocompromised, those admitted to the ICU, children at risk for influenza-related complications, and also in the emergency department in febrile kids where you don't know what's going on, it can be very helpful to get a positive viral result. So I wouldn't throw the baby out with the bathwater with this, but certainly indiscriminate viral testing that happens inpatient is probably not the best.
So abstract 28 is along the same line of testing. This is rapid antigen testing for group A strep in kids with pharyngitis. And it says if the test is negative, the chance that you have group A strep is pretty low. You could probably stop and not treat. But many people have pointed out to me in endemic areas, for example, in the Australian Aboriginal populations, that is such a high prevalence of disease, they don't believe the negatives.
Yeah, and I have a hard time believing that an expensive test and treat strategy is the ultimate right way to go on this. So it always makes me feel a little uncomfortable when people are advocating more testing. Abstract 29, this is a systematic review from Oregon Health Sciences that looks at the predictive performance, predicting outcomes, using just the motor component of the Glasgow Coma Scale versus the whole thing. So like a 1 to 6 instead of a 3 to 15 result. And basically, it underperforms. It doesn't even do as well as the Glasgow Coma Scale, which you could argue isn't that great itself. So not a lot of practice change there.
It's hard to get worse than the Glasgow Coma Scale.
But I do notice that there are a lot of neurosurgeons that really want to just focus on the motor scale, and that is a practice out there.
And lastly, abstract 30 is patient outcomes at an urban, suburban level 1 versus level 2. This is Amy Cardew, who's a friend of the show, Annals of Emergency Medicine. Very difficult methodologically to determine whether a level 1 trauma center is better or worse than a level 2 trauma center. They suggest in this study that maybe the level 2 trauma center was better looking after patients in level 1. But the only way to do this is literally to do a randomized trial. There's too many variables here, so it's difficult. And that's why our database, the world's database, shows it all over the board as to which one's better. And maybe that means there's not much difference. Ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, that's your Ultra Summary. His name is Stuart Swadron.
And his name, Melvis P. Q. Herbert.
Thank you.
Hi, everybody. This is Jerry Huffman, and this is what I guess they're now calling by, quote, deep dive into the February issue of EMA. As usual, I've been asked to comment on a few of the papers that were in this issue, and I've also picked a couple of others that I think are worth a brief comment. So let's just get started. The ones that Jan and Raman asked me to talk about start with number 6, the validation of the Ottawa subarachnoid hemorrhage rule by Perry et al. I want to add a couple of things to what they have said. Both of them appropriately commented that this won't save a lot of workups doing this because the specificity is so terrible at 13%. And that means that you're changing the number you work up from almost everybody to almost everybody, teeny bit less. But that assumes that it's okay and you'll get a little benefit, 5% fewer workups because you adapted this rule and you won't miss anybody. And so there's two problems with that. One is that we have to imagine that it's true that we won't miss anybody. And that's based on things that this study can't tell us, and it's mostly based on what these guys have claimed in the past. Their claim has been that a negative CT is enough to get you through and you don't have to do any more. And I've spoken many times in the past why I think that is not remotely proven, and I still believe that's true. So the notion that you will not miss anybody is, to my mind, in no ways proven by this study. And even if you believed it, the confidence intervals around the numbers that they have would not exclude that you'd miss somebody. If, in fact, this gets you only a 5% fewer workup rate, and it might miss somebody, and I suspect it might miss more than the occasional somebody, that's, to my mind, not a particularly good trade-off. The other thing is that we're talking about doing fewer workups, but in fact, this Ottawa so-called rule includes doing a lot of workups on a lot of people that I wouldn't start doing anything on because they're doing all sorts of tests in these people. So not only is it that you're going to decrease your ultimate workup only by a tiny bit, but you're, in order to do that, you're going to do lots and lots of tests that I think are unnecessary. And I just want to remind people that if you look at the literature about thunderclap headache, and what I mean by that is not that it was within an hour, as is defined in this paper, but rather that if you look at the people who are really at risk for an acute subarachnoid, and those are the people who have very sudden onset within a minute, and even more important, perhaps, maximal at onset. It's not like you get a really bad headache all of a sudden and then it gets worse and worse and worse. It's maximal at onset. That's probably the critical thing. If you look at the literature about maximal at onset headaches, and I have to admit it's not a massive literature, but I think it's a reasonable literature, at least gives us an idea, about 15% of those, apparently, end up being a subarachnoid hemorrhage. That means a lot of them are not, but about one out of six are. So if you were to use that alone, forget all the other stuff, forget doing workups, forget asking a million questions, forget asking things like, are they over 40, which to me makes no sense at all, because I've seen subarachnoids in people under 40. Why would you use that as a criterion? If you just used, is it a true thunderclap maximal at onset, that means that 5 out of 6 workups that you did would be negative. So the specificity is 15%, which is actually better, or at least as good as the specificity of this whole cockamamie rule. And I think it will basically get you all the patients who have a subarachnoid bleed. So I remain skeptical about all of this and about the notion that a CT only is good enough. Not to mention, by the way, that these guys didn't even do a workup in more than 10% of the patients, which means that even further reason to not believe that they didn't miss anybody. The second paper that I was asked to talk about was the effect of the ACA on ED visits. And these guys did a really, really nice job in their discussion. Raman in particular covered most of the issues that I think really matter. But let's go back to, what is this really about? So what was the ACA designed to do? What was its purpose? Well, it was to increase access to care. And let's not confuse increased access to care with, where should they go to get care? Should it be the ED or should it be primary care? These are two entirely separate things. Now, unfortunately, in our so-called healthcare system, millions of people traditionally do not have access to care. And while the ACA is only at best a partial fix to that, it did at least decrease the number of people who had no access to care except in an extreme emergency. So would that likely increase their going to the doctor? Of course it would. Is that a good thing? Of course it is. Our system is tremendously troubled with both overdoing and underdoing. And the underdoing is in the people who traditionally don't have access to care. And giving them access to care has to be a good thing. Then the question becomes, well, will they just abuse the ED and not go to a primary care doctor? And that's an entirely separate question that is a complicated one for reasons that Raman and Jan discussed. And I don't want to go in through all of it now, but I'll just point out that long before there was the ACA, people with traditional insurance also often went to the ED when, in retrospect, you might think it would have been preferable for them to go to primary care. And, you know, let's be honest, the reason for that is because we don't have a privileged primary care system. That is to say, we would be much better off if we had a much better, more access primary care system that would lead to better outcomes. In fact, good primary care is probably the best predictor of outcome from a healthcare system. It's a really important thing. And in the United States, we tremendously undervalue primary care. In the interim, while we don't value primary care the way we should, guess what happens? A lot of people go to the ED. And in this system, that's usually probably a good thing for lots of reasons, including the fact that even in retrospect, some of the people who looked like they had nothing ended up having an emergency, and it was a good thing they went to the emergency department. That's not to say everybody should be running to the emergency department, but for lots of reasons, patient-centered reasons, that's what they do today because it's much more efficient and convenient and less expensive to them, because of our crazy profit-driven healthcare system. So if you really want to fix this, you got to do much better than the ACA. We got to change from a profit-driven healthcare system to a patient-driven healthcare system, one that really values health and patient outcomes rather than who's making the money. But in our system, allowing patients to have access to care, including emergency department care, is of course better than having millions and millions of uninsured. So I think, as Raman and Jen talked about, the authors of this paper are really asking the wrong questions and focusing on the wrong things. The third paper is number 14, Time to API and Risk. of an adverse outcome in children. And I think it may well be true that delay in many patients is okay. And I like what Jan and Raman said about making individual decisions. It's not one size fits all. There are some people you're worried about, some you're not, etc. But within that larger notion, I think, yeah, there are certainly some patients where delay probably is okay. But I have to disagree with the comment that one of them made about how this is evidence for that, because this paper really isn't evidence at all. And let me tell you why. What they did is took all the kids who eventually went to the OR, forget about the silly fact that they excluded all the people who got a CT scan, which of course makes it a little ridiculous, and forget the non-blinded review, which also makes it ridiculous. Let's just talk about one really fatal flaw to that conclusion. They took all the people who ended up in the OR, and they looked and they said, you know, the people who went there, the OR early, had the same number of perfs as the people who went to the OR late, and therefore going to the OR late didn't matter. Well, wait a second, that's ridiculous. Because if you come in with obviously sick and you have already had a perf, what happens? You go to the OR right now. The people who are really sick and are perfed go to the OR right now. So let's assume that there's X percent of patients who are like that. Let's call it 5% just for a second. So 5% of the people go to the OR with a perf right now because it's obvious clinically that they have a perf. Now, if that means that the percent who have a delayed operation is the same as the percent who have an early operation, you'd say, well, 5% have a later perf. And those were people who were not clinically obvious initially and probably didn't have a perf at the time that they presented. So if, in fact, the two numbers are the same, that would mean the same number of people, X percent, 5%, are perfing because you delayed. Now, I personally think that it's not quite that simple and that many patients can be safely put off, particularly in the age of giving them antibiotics. But this paper is not evidence that it's safe to delay. If anything, it suggests that you're causing perfs in just as many people as those who presented already perfed. Number 19 is about lumbar puncture for all infants 29 to 56 days old. And both Raman and Jan talked about the major methodological flaws in this paper. It was a chart review with absolutely no methods. And they, of course, then explain away things that are uncomfortable for them. So they called everything false positive if they didn't like it to be a true positive bacterial meningitis, including two E. coli. Excuse me, this is an obvious example of a biased methodology. In addition, the exclusions of people who are already sick and on antibiotics, etc., as the commentator discussed, make everything else a little bit silly. But I just want to make a comment in general about this overall notion. There was a time where we said, you know, any kid under 3 months needs the, not we, but there was general notion that any kid under 3 months with a fever needs to be worked up. Then people said, you know what, you can evaluate them clinically. You don't have to do it in 3 months, 2 months maybe, or maybe even 1 month. And in fact, there were a lot of people who were saying that you can evaluate clinically a kid, you know, after a month. If they look well, they're probably pretty okay. This probably depends a little bit on your own experience. And if you're uncomfortable with that, yeah, it's a different thing. Or if you're not sure, this kid, I'm not sure if it's okay or not. Okay. But most everybody agreed that no matter how good you are and how much experience you have, you're not very good at the really little tiny babies. What does that mean, little tiny? Does that mean 28 days, 24 days, 22 days? I don't know. It's probably different for all of us. But the really little tiny kids, if they're really sick, obviously clinically, that's a no-brainer. But if they look well, that doesn't mean they are well, because we're just not good enough to tell what's normal in that really little kid. So that's why there's been a notion that there's some cutoff. I don't know that what the exact number is, but somewhere around a month or maybe a little bit more, maybe a tiny bit less, where you really shouldn't just rely on clinical judgment, because no matter which of these algorithms you use, we're just not able to tell in the kid who doesn't look obviously sick. Now, along comes the age of vaccinations, and now we have a changed scenario where almost none of these kids actually have anything because they've been immunized, and the rate of true bacterial meningitis in these kids is so small, and some of them already look obviously clinically sick. So the ones who don't look clinically sick, maybe most of them are okay. And I think that's true. Where do we reach the inflection, though, where it's okay to say, I can't tell, but you're likely to be okay, where that's better than doing a workup? What is it, 1 in 1,000, 1 in 10,000, 1 in 100,000? When the outcome, if you miss it, can be really, really devastating. Lifelong neurologic problems for an infant who you might have been able to keep from having any problems. I don't have an answer for that, but I think that's really the question. And it is undoubtedly true that very few of the kids who look well, even if they're teensy, teensy, weeny, very few of them really are sick. But now you have to do some sort of analysis of what's the harm of missing 1 in 1,000, 10,000, whatever it is, versus the harm of overdoing. And that's a really important question, but I don't think we have the answer for that, which leads me to suggest that this may be something where talking to parents about it really is important, because they should have a say in whether or not we should torture their child and do a big workup, including an LP, and maybe put them on antibiotics. And that isn't always safe for a very, very, very rare save. Now, of course, we need better information to give them so that they can make a rational decision. But I think this is, remains unsettled. So as the as Jan and Raman said, everybody's a little uncomfortable with this, and maybe we should, it should vary according to how comfortable you are with the kid and exactly how old they are and whether they have any underlying problems. But maybe it should also vary with, let's get some more information, and also let's give parents an opportunity to chime in to, about how they would like us to proceed. The final one that they asked me to talk about was the one about capsaicin, number 22, and cannabis hyperemesis. And I got to say, to me, you know, I have no experience with this. And maybe if you have nothing else you can do, this is a reasonable thing to try. It probably isn't all that dangerous, even though it's uncomfortable. And so maybe it's okay. And I heard Raman say that he's tried it and or he saw it once. The two of them, I can't remember which one said, but they both agreed, oh, yeah, they thought it might work. But it's very easy to fool ourselves about this. And this paper certainly is a great example of fooling yourself. It's a classic chart review with no methods where they could find anything they want. So they said, you know, we gave it after we gave other things and the people got better. But even after they got better, they continued to give many of them other antiemetics. So why was that if they really got better? In addition, the two people where the first thing they did, we didn't give the antiemetics, they just went straight to capsaicin. Both of them they then gave antiemetics to. So how is it that the authors claim that everybody got better with capsaicin if they had to give other antiemetics both times that they started with capsaicin and in many of the other cases where it supposedly was curative? But here's the really good part. Hidden in the discussion, but nowhere in the results, is the following direct quote. Multiple patients in this series refused to believe that capsaicin cream was the source of their symptom relief and therefore refused to continue taking capsaicin cream. Excuse me? The patients didn't think it was what made them better, but the authors tell us it must have been. I don't know how many multiple is, but there's only 13 in this whole thing. So this is a little bit crazy. I think what they're actually saying is, we don't have any evidence whatsoever that this worked. The patients didn't think it worked. We kept giving antiemetics to a lot of the patients. Maybe in one or two, it seemed to work. But this is far from anything remotely like evidence. That's the five that they asked me to talk about. I want to make a couple of quick comments about five other papers. I'm going to do it really quick. So the number two is about a history and physical to identify ACS in the ED. And Jan reviewed very nicely about what might be useful from this, about which clinical findings predict what. But I want to comment about the author's claim that Gestalt, like the Framingham risk factors, isn't adequately sensitive. So therefore, quote, we most patients will need an EKG and troponin. And I just want to point out that I think this is crazy. Most patients don't need that. Most patients do need clinical judgment because virtually all the extra cases that are found by looking at high sensitivity troponin turn out to be overdiagnosis. Maybe it's true that they have a troponin leak, but they did fine before we ever did anything. And all we're doing is harm by doing this over-worrying about them. And why don't we ask the question, how much harm are we doing in order to find that last subtle case of trivial, quote, ACS? Because we're doing lots and lots of harm and almost no, if any, benefit. Number three, the delayed Lazarus phenomenon. Sorry, I got to say this. I don't think this means what people are saying. I don't think it means we have to monitor them for a very long time. I do like a lot of what Jan and Raman said about this, but I'll tell you, in my experience, it's not that uncommon where you stop the code and then 2 minutes later somebody says, oh, Eber just breathed, or somebody forgot to turn off the monitor and there was a few blips. And then you go like, what do? You scratch your head. Do we start again? And then you usually start again, and then you call it 10 minutes later. And that's exactly what was found in this paper. They continued to doing it for 10 minutes, and five people had the Lazarus phenomenon. They came back to life. No, they didn't. They were dead within 15 minutes, three of them. And the other two were dead, one in an hour and one in 24 hours. Was it worth finding these people? Did you do any good? Now, maybe there's another patient somewhere in the universe who did wake up and get better, and you certainly hate to call that patient dead. Maybe that's possible. We know that from the old days, that in the coffin, sometimes people used to pull on the string because they weren't really dead. We thought they were dead, and they weren't really dead. Now, I don't think that happens after CPR very often, but I guess it's possible. But if you're going to do that, then don't say monitor them for 10 minutes, monitor them for an hour. Because maybe they'll be in an hour, they'll wake up. Or how about a month? Maybe in the coffin they woke up. Maybe we should monitor them. Maybe we should go to all the graveyards and start digging them up just in case somebody's really alive. This is crazy. This is not return of life. It's return of some trivial electrical activity that is meaningless. And all these patients died. And I like what the group said, what Raman and Jan said, about the family. You have the family there, and you leave the monitor on, and then you get them all excited, and it doesn't do any good. Turn the monitor off. And be sure to tell the family that it's possible that every once in a while there'll be a breath or something, but it doesn't mean anything, because all we could do is cause pain by extending this period forever. When they're dead, that's usually a pretty bad prognostic sign. Number 10, the upcoming thumb sign. Really nice discussion. And I just want to stress that, yes, as with all things in a physical exam, it's not good enough. That doesn't mean you can't consider it, but the evidence in this paper is really, really poor. And the notion of it was 60% in one group and 40% in the other group, and that's useful, is crazy. And the authors, of course, try to explain it away. Don't believe that. Well, some of them had a prior TIA. This is ridiculous. This is not going to be terribly... I doubt it'll be useful. Maybe you should consider it and add it to your armamentarium, but I certainly would encourage you not to believe that if the thumb goes up, it means one thing, and if it doesn't, it means something else, because that's not what the study showed. It was almost equally true in both groups. Number 28, the accuracy of the rapid antigen testing. I just want to say everything about this paper, I believe, is wrong. Jan talked about, here's what IDSA tells you, but IDSA is not the only one writing a guideline. CDC wrote a guideline as well, has a guideline. Michelle Cooper and I were the ones who were its primary authors in its last version. Now it's been updated and it says the same thing. And those disagree completely with IDSA. And they say you shouldn't be doing these testing. And there's a lot of reason for that, including that, as Jan and Raman said, we're not actually making anything better by treating, even if it is strep. Rheumatic fever doesn't exist in our country, essentially. The superative complications are not decreased. You can decrease the symptoms, maybe with antibiotics, by a teeny little bit, but you can decrease them just as much by just giving symptomatic care. And you don't need antibiotics for that. So one could argue that you should never give antibiotics in the first place, and you certainly don't need to go looking for it. But if you're going to give antibiotics, give it to a person who's really sick and has a lot of central criteria. And by the way, the other thing to just mention that I've talked about many times in the past is that the gold standard for all of this is a throat culture. That's how they know that the RAT test was good. And the throat culture is a terrible gold standard for lots of reasons, with many false positives and false negatives that we've talked about a lot before. So the authors of this paper, I disagree with virtually everything they said, their claims about it. And I personally believe we should be doing this all on a clinical basis. If they look really sick and have very positive CENTAUR, you can consider antibiotics. Otherwise, don't, and don't do any of these ridiculous tests. And I just want to give a shout-out on number 30 to Amy Kaji and the group at Harbor about level 1 versus level 2 trauma centers. There are reasons why this doesn't really prove that it's better to be at a level 1, but I would like to say that this is really a fundamental question of what is done in an emergency department. Then, from my standpoint, it's essential emergency medicine is that we're there to evaluate patients and then decide if we need some help. We do that with cardiac patients. We do it with stroke patients. We do it with infectious disease patients. The more that people tell us you must call a consult on everybody, the worse it is. It's not only an insult to what we do, but it also leads to harm. That's what we're there for, is to decide who needs it. And that's the difference between a level 1 and a level 2. That's the main difference. The other differences are trivial. In a level 2, you decide which patient gets the trauma team called. In a level 1, the trauma team comes out of themselves. I'm not surprised that results should be worse in a level 1 because the surgeons overdo all sorts of things, including pan scanning, that actually ends up harming patients. It's not beneficial. So what I want in my emergency department, what I'd want if I was a trauma patient, is that a really good emergency physician to evaluate the patient and then have very rapid access to a surgeon if needed, remembering that the vast majority of patients with major trauma never go to the operating room for anything but orthopedics. They don't need a trauma surgeon. And the few who do need a trauma surgeon, that's our job, is to decide who they are. And it's also our job to do all the resuscitation in the 20 minutes that the trauma surgeon is getting there. It's almost impossible to imagine a patient where you need the trauma surgeon in that first 20 minutes. What you need is access to a trauma surgeon who'll come there rapidly when you need them, because we do need them sometimes. We can't do everything, but we can do the initial evaluation and the initial resuscitation. So I think there's better evidence than this paper that level twos are exactly what you need. It not only saves money and saves time and saves excessive workups, but leads to at least as good outcomes. That's it for me for today. Thanks for listening, and I'll talk with you next time. Take care. Bye.
Hey, Rick Picotta here. Thanks for tuning in. Recently, I picked up a bottle of Cordis-Born ear drops. Not the trade name version, but the generic version. The price, catch this, $56. $56 for 10 mLs of a drug that has been around at least 40 years. But if you really wanted to get the trade name version, you won't believe this. It's $200. These prices are come off of the website goodrx.com. I think that if you ever have to buy a drug and pay money for it, you're not covered by insurance, go to goodrx.com. They have coupons for just about everything. And I don't know how they do it, but they save money on drugs if you get the coupon. The coupon's free. Take it to a bunch of different pharmacies. What's the heck's going on here with this thing here? We got a generic drug that's been around for all this time, that is made up of stuff that costs pennies. I mean, what can the ingredients of this thing cost? And yet it's $56. And that was with my Part D insurance. And so you're helping me pay for this drug, you know. We all know that for a long, long time, the American people have been really gouged by the pharmaceutical industry. Let's go through a few facts. First of all, the worldwide sales of drugs, $1.05 trillion. $1.05 trillion. That's a year. Half of that, actually more than half of that, $515 billion, comes from the United States. And we only represent 7% of the world's population. So we are taking tons and tons and tons of pills. And we are probably also paying much higher prices than anybody on the planet. Of the top 10 pharmaceuticals on the Fortune 500 list, the average profit was 22% in 2016. That's a lot, you know. That's the average. What does that compare with all the other companies on the Fortune 500? Well, if you exclude the energy companies, which basically make nothing right now, the average profit is 10%. So pharmaceuticals are more than double that. And what do the CEOs of the top 10 pharmaceutical companies make on average in 2016? Only $32.7 million. Only $32.7 million. Well, you know, the highest profits were with this company called Gilead. You've heard of them. They came up with this pill for hepatitis C. And what does that pill cost? $1,000 a pill. $1,000. And so you're supposed to take that pill for 12 weeks, seven times a week, $84,000 is what the therapy costs. They say, well, that's cheaper than a liver transplant, and that's probably true, but I don't really know what percentage of people with hepatitis C are going to need a liver transplant. So, you know, that's kind of nasty. Here's another interesting fact about Gilead. I saw this chart where they look at how much money is brought in per employee. Well, Gilead is at the top of the list. For every employee that they have, they bring in $4.1 million. $4.1 million is like, do you believe that? The lowest company on the top 10, they brought in $400,000 per employee. So we got this idea here that drug companies are highly profitable. When you rank it, the makers of the generics are at the top of the list. Of all the industries, their profit is 30%. They're followed by investment banking, which is in the neighborhood of 29%. Tobacco, holy smokes, tobacco? Yeah, 27% is their profit. And then underneath that are the major pharmaceutical companies, the Lillys and the Mercks. They make, at least according to this statistic, 25%. I just quoted you 22%. So there's a little slop there with regard to that 3%. And what about returns to investors? Eli Lilly topped the list. In 2015, it returned 25% to investors. Eli Lilly, hasn't that name been in the news lately? Wait. I think I remember here. Yeah. The November 14th issue of the L.A. Times. Second page, full page. And I must admit, the L.A. Times is a very, very liberal newspaper. So they're not big fans of the Trump folks. It was all about the nomination of a new person to head Health and Human Services, under which the FDA is a part. Alec Azar is his name, A-Z-A-R, Alec Azar. Tom Price got fired because he decided to use government jets when he should be flying commercial. It was thought to be about $400,000 he burned up. So he resigned or got fired, either one, I don't know. Who is this Mr. Azar? Well, in the George W. Bush's reign, he was with the Health and Human Services. Actually, he held a pretty high position from 2005 to 2007. After that was over, he later started working for Eli Lilly. Yes, Eli Lilly, the company that's paying the most to its stockholders. In any case, he worked for Eli Lilly for a while, and for the last 5 years, he's been the president of Eli Lilly. So what is the president of Eli Lilly supposed to do for Eli Lilly? They're supposed to maximize the profits of that company, maximize the profits for it and its shareholders. So what's the likelihood that this fellow is going to do 180 degrees flop and now support the American people in the terms of getting fairness for their expenditures regarding drugs? I think it's probably pretty slight. You got to remember that the pharmaceutical industry is already extremely powerful in Washington. As of October 17th of 2017, this year, over $208 million was spent by the pharmaceutical industry. So says the Senate Office of Public Records in terms of its lobbying efforts. How many lobbyists do they have? You'll never, ever, ever guess the number of lobbyists. 1,389 lobbyists are registered representing the pharmaceutical industry. And what have they gotten for the pharmaceutical industry? Well, there's no regulation of any prices on drugs. It's whatever the market will bear. That's how you get the $1,000 for Hep C and $600 for EpiPens and, you know, all this other ridiculous stuff. And Americans can't buy drugs from Canada because it's totally unsafe to buy drugs there. They're made in the same plants as slaughterhouses, you know, and everything's contaminated, and all the Canadian people are being killed by the Canadian drugs, of course, but we can't buy them. They want to protect us from the horrors of the Canadian market. The fact of the matter is I'm sure there are big drug companies who have factories there that are bringing the drugs that they make right into the United States. A proposal by Bernie Sanders, which has absolutely no chance of passing anywhere, is proposed to decrease American drug prices by 35 to 55% if we could get them out of Canada. And some states in the New England area have said it's okay if you get drugs out of Canada. I think Maine was one of them. It's like, you know, ignoring the rules about marijuana, the state say, well, I know there's a federal law about marijuana. We're going to pass it, making it legal here anyway. And the government basically just kind of backs off on that. What else we got going here? Oh, yeah. Medicare cannot negotiate with the drug companies over the cost of Part D drugs. That was part of the arrangement for a Part D. Can you imagine the profit that is now being made by the pharmaceutical industry over this little clause? Medicare cannot negotiate with the pharmaceutical industry. The VA can, the military can, but not Medicare, which is probably the biggest buyer of drugs in this country. What a gift that was. I saw a graph of pharmaceutical company profits, and it just freaking shot up in 2006 when all of this stuff became into effect. What about the ability to extend their patents? They've got every trick in the book that you can think of. Like, they can make minor improvements in a drug, change that molecule here, move it there, and it's a new drug. And they can get another 17 years out of it. You can combine two drugs that are, you know, no big deal into one pill, and that's now a new drug. Or you can find new indications for a drug. In fact, that's how Viagra's sildenafil, it was originally patented for blood pressure, and they found that it didn't do much for blood pressure, but it did erect penises, and so they changed that and subsequently got a different patent for that indication. Let me give you a couple of examples. What about albuterol inhalers? They used to be about $20 to get one of those inhalers. But when they required that the propellant be changed to protect the ozone layer, which all of the these inhalers were killing, it basically allowed these drugs to be considered new drugs. New drugs, patentable new drugs. You go on to GoodRx now, the price without one of their little coupons is now $70, with something that used to be $20. And there is no albuterol generic inhalers anymore. So we're talking about things like Ventolin, $70. And what else costs $70? Viagra used to cost about $25 a pill when it first came out. Now the cost is $70. They've been progressively increasing the price of this drug over time. And I wonder how they determined in the beginning that the price should be $25, because it obviously got nothing to do with the cost of developing or making that drug. And I think they got a bunch of guys in a room and said, what would you pay for an erection? And I guess the number came out to be $25. And gradually they said, well, you know, cost of living increases and inflation and all that. No, we're going to make it now $70 a pill. Fortunately, Teva Pharmaceuticals is allowed to make a generic version of Viagra as of December 11th of this year. Whoop-de-doo. Now, they still have to pay Pfizer a royalty for 3 years. And after that, there's going to be a flood of people making generic Viagra. And the same thing by 2018, the patent runs out on Cialis as well. So how are they going to try to kind of protect themselves? They may do the same thing that they did with loratadine, which is an antihistamine, which was originally by prescription. They made it over-the-counter, and now it's called Claritin. So Claritin basically has this huge share of the antihistamine market. And what they want to do, these drug companies want to do, is make Viagra and Cialis over-the-counter. That doesn't mean it's going to be any cheaper necessarily, but it'll be over the counter and therefore will not require a prescription. And most men are not particularly interested in going to their doctor and asking for a prescription for these drugs. So this will just end run the doctors, and it has the potential to be hugely profitable for the sale of these drugs. And there's other ways as well, but, you know, enough is enough. There's a lot of other information. You know, we could spend hours on, you know, fact after fact after fact about how we're getting kicked in the head by these drug companies. But I guess the point of this rant is that Trump, in his campaign, said we need to decrease the prices of drugs. Yet he appoints this guy, or is nominating this guy. It's the fox watching the chicken coop, for crying out loud. You know, we're supposed to be draining the swamp. Well, I don't think it's really going to be happening in the Health and Human Services. And that's got nothing to do with, their attempt to decrease the effects of Obamacare. This is just one little piece. In any case, I think I feel a little bit better now getting this off of the chest. Not much, because we can't do a damn thing about it. Thanks for listening, and bye for now.
Hello, M-Rappers. It's time to talk a little nerdy. And I'm your host, Ken Milne. This month, I'm going to be talking about acute and chronic back pain in the emergency department. As always, the basis for all these episodes comes from the lecture series created for the emergency medicine and acute care courses. Thank you to Dr. James Ducharme for writing the original lecture. Now, these episodes are broken down into digestible chunks, but only represent a starting point, and you should be skeptical of anything you hear. I encourage you to always go back and read the primary literature. How you apply the literature to your patients in your practice environment will depend on many factors. To start with, low back pain is an extremely common presentation to U.S. emergency departments, representing about 2.4% or almost 3 million visits annually. The vast majority of the presentations are benign in etiology, but these patients can be complex, confusing, and frustrating to deal with for many reasons, which include, number one, the lack of objective findings in most patients. Two, potential for misrepresentation of symptoms due to secondary gain, such as avoiding work. Three, the recognition that some make use of back symptoms in an effort to obtain medications for abuse. The fourth, the risk of failing to identify the 1% or less with malignancy or spinal infection. And the fifth, patient expectations that advanced imaging will somehow aid in their outcome. Now, in this episode, we're going to limit the discussion to the management of patients with actual back pain. We will not be discussing patients with secondary gain or those with intention to divert or misuse prescription medications. So let's start to talk a little nerdy about acute and chronic back pain in the emergency department with asking five questions. And we'll draw on the extensive EMA database to try and address each of these questions. So here are the five questions. The first one is, what are the back pain red flags? The second one is, I want my MRI, but will imaging tests make a difference? The third question, what about pharmacologic treatments? The fourth question, what about non-pharmacological treatments? And the fifth and final question, how long will I have this back pain? So here we go with question number one. What are the back pain red flags? Now, there are multiple red flag lists to help identify patients at risk for more serious causes of their back pain. Now, no list is comprehensive. One simple red flag list was made by Dr. Salim Razai from Rebel EM, and he called his list tuna fish. So let's run through what tuna fish means. T stands for trauma. U is unexplained weight loss. N is neurologic symptoms, and A is age over 50. Oh, I'm so close to that now. So that covers the tuna. Now for the fishy part. F stands for fever. I is for intravenous drug use. S for steroid use. And H, history of cancer. And now specifically prostate, renal, breast, and lung. Other things to consider, though, would be immunocompromised patients besides just those on steroids. As an example, HIV patients, diabetics, alcoholics, or patients on biologic agents who are at risk for discitis, spinal epidural abscesses, or osteomyelitis. Now, in a very discouraging systematic review by Downey et al. That identified 53 red flags used in studies. Now, many of the lists that they used did not increase the diagnostic accuracy for finding fractures or serious pathology. The only evidence-supported red flag for malignancy in the spine was a history of malignancy. Now, many of us will look at things such as immunocompromised states with fever, bowel or bladder symptoms, etc. But this review failed to find evidence to support their routine use. And we have to remember, though, that the absence of evidence of effect does not mean there is evidence of absence of effect. So clinical experience, a key part of evidence-based medicine, has shown us that certain red flags are of high value. Okay, so question number two. I want my MRI. But will imaging tests make a difference? It's rare that back pain patients benefit from an MRI. Despite this, many orthopedic surgeons or pain specialists will insist on one prior to assessing a referred patient. This professional mindset fosters a patient's mindset. Well, my specialist wants an MRI to know what's going on. And we need to try to discourage this in patients. It is clear that back-dominated low back pain with no red flags does not require imaging of any kind. The American College of Physicians published their clinical guidelines for low back pain in 2011. They recommend use of X-rays and ESRs only in patients with major risk factors for cancer, while reserving MRIs to those with neurologic deficits, symptoms of cord compression, or those at risk for spinal infections. It behooves us to be carefully examining these patients to ensure they do not meet criteria for imaging, as the initial finding for cauda equina syndrome or for spinal epidural abscess may be subtle. These conditions are often missed on their initial presentation with devastating consequences. Now, we do have an abstract in this review that strongly advocates for decreasing imaging of the lower back. It's called Less is More, and it says that early imaging in low back pain in patients without red flags leads to overtesting, potential harms, greater costs, and overdiagnosis. It was part of a project by the National Physicians Alliance called Promoting Good Stewardship in Clinical Practice. Now, we're probably more familiar with the Choose Wisely campaign. ASAP is part of that. And ASAP has a statement on this, and it says, quote, avoid lumbar spine imaging in the emergency department for adults with non-traumatic back pain unless the patient has severe or progressive neurologic deficits or is suspected of having a serious underlying condition, such as vertebral infection, cauda equina syndrome, or cancer with bony metastasis. CAPE, and that's the Canadian Association of Emergency Physicians, has a similar statement. Now, there is a systematic review trying to determine if MRI findings can tease out what would be the best treatment for patients with low back pain or sciatica. Bottom line is, the management is rarely surgical, with only a few trials finding benefit at 1 year. Now, there is one study that did show benefit of surgery over conservative care for central disc herniation. More importantly, leg-dominant pain needs to be recognized for the pain type that it is. It is primarily neuropathic in nature, and so will not benefit from standard analgesics such as acetaminophen or short-acting opioids. Medications such as tricyclics, pentanoids, and NSAIDs are more first-line therapies than usual analgesics. If one of the first two classes is initiated in the ED, close follow-up to continue titration to effect is required. And so I threw a little bit of medication in at the end of this second section, but it's a nice way to transition into question number three. Question number three is, what about pharmacologic treatments? Many different treatment modalities have been tried to treat low back pain with limited success. We'll start with a couple of the most common pharmacologic treatments, acetaminophen and NSAIDs. Williams et al. Did a double-blind, randomized, placebo-controlled trial of approximately 1,600 patients. Now, the patients got acetaminophen either regularly or on an as-needed basis, or there was a placebo group. And they found no difference in functionality or quality of life at 12 weeks. The authors therefore state that acetaminophen offered no benefit. However, we do not know if pain relief was better in the first week or the second week after acute onset, as the authors did not comment on pain relief. In addition, these were not patients recruited from the emergency department. Now, there's a study by Machadro et al. Demonstrated in a systematic review and meta-analysis that NSAIDs did not provide clinically important effects over placebo for spine pain. They included patients with acute and chronic lumbar and cervical pain. However, the point estimates for the subgroup analysis of acute low back pain was less than the pre-specified 10 points between group differences considered to be clinically significant. And there's a study by Friedman et al., and this was in JAMA 2015, and it showed that adding a muscle relaxant like cyclobenzaprine or oxycodone acetaminophen combination to an NSAID, and in this case naproxen, alone did not improve functional outcomes or pain at 1 week, but did markedly increase side effects in about the 300 adults with non-traumatic, non-radicular musculoskeletal low back pain. Steroids, well, that's another treatment modality that has been tried for low back pain. A double-blinded trial of adult patients in the ED with acute low back pain and radiculopathy has been published. Now, in this study, the patients received either a single dose of 8 milligrams of IV dexamethasone or normal saline in addition to oxycodone. The steroid treatment was reported to shorten the ED length of stay and decrease pain up to 6 weeks after discharge for patients presenting with leg-dominant pain. But it has to be noted that the pain scale difference was minimal. It was 0.8 out of 10 at time of discharge and 0.4 out of 10 at 6 weeks. Well, there was no difference in functional capacity. Now, when we're looking at decreases in pain, we typically think of 1.3 centimeters on a 10 centimeter visual analog scale as being a difference to be considered clinically significant. And so a 0.8 or a 0.4 would not be considered clinically significant, although it was statistically significant. And I think key to that is there was no difference in functional capacity in the outcome. In addition, the studies looking at spinal injections with steroids for mechanical low back pain have found no value in the treatment. Well, how about adding a little benzodiazepine to an NSAID to help treat patients with acute, non-traumatic, non-radicular low back pain? Another randomized control trial by Friedman et al. Of over 100 ED patients looked at adding 5 to 10 milligrams of diazepam to 500 milligrams of naproxen. It too found no improvement in functional outcome between the two groups. Based on this data, it does not appear that diazepam should be routinely added to an NSAID in these patients. Now, there's a Turkish study comparing IV acetaminophen to morphine to dexketoprofen with an outcome at 30 minutes for the primary measure in 137 patients. Now, pain decreased to a mean score of 1 in all three groups, but 10 to 20% of the patients in each arm required rescue medication. They were considered equivalent in pain relief they provided, but there could be no conclusions drawn from this as what might be effective at home. All right, now for a brief discussion on the elephant in the room, opioids. ASAP has some guidelines with the American Pain Society from 2007 on the use of opioids. They state opioids should be reserved for severe disabling pain that is not controlled or not likely to be controlled with NSAIDs or acetaminophen. Well, this will be challenging considering the limited effectiveness of NSAIDs and acetaminophen. That's the data I just presented. ASAP also has a clinical policy on prescribing opioids that specifically addresses patients with acute low back pain. They give three Level C recommendations. Their first Level C recommendation is for patients being discharged from the ED with acute low back pain, the emergency physician should ascertain whether non-opioid analgesics and non-pharmacological therapies will be adequate for initial pain management. The second point in their clinical policy is that given a lack of demonstrated evidence of superior efficacy of either opioids or non-opioid analgesics and the individual and community risks associated with opioid use, misuse, and abuse, opioids should be reserved for more severe pain or pain refractory to other analgesics rather than routinely prescribed. And the third and final point in this ASAP clinical policy If opioids are indicated, the prescription should be for the lowest practical dose for a limited duration, example 1 week, and the prescriber should consider the patient's risk for opioid misuse, abuse, or diversion. Well, opioids do work for pain, but they do come with significant issues that are beyond the scope of this episode. The rest of the drugs used really have limited evidence of efficacy. This can contribute to the frustration in treating these patients with low back pain. I want to bring up one other point, though, and that's about ketamine. Ketamine has been available in the medical practice for more than 50 years. And despite it being a generic product for more than 20 years, it has been the single most researched analgesic every year for the past decade. And there are a number of papers specifically looking at ketamine for pain relief in the emergency department. And it's often used as an adjunct at a subdissociative dose of 0.1 to 0.3 milligrams per kilogram IV. One of the world's leaders in this area of research is a guy by the name of Dr. Sergey Motov out of New York. I'm going to list 5 papers that talk about ketamine for pain relief, and they'll be in the actual notes. All right, question number 4. What about non-pharmacologic treatments? We've talked about pharmacological treatments, and we've talked about MRIs and imaging. Let's talk about non-pharmacologic treatments. Atraumatic back pain is rarely limited to nociceptive pain, that is, pain from injury or inflammation. There's almost always a neuropathic component as well, especially as the duration of the pain exceeds more than 1 to 2 weeks. The failure to recognize the mixed nature of pain often results in either inappropriate analgesic prescription or inadequate pain relief, or both. The nature of back pain, like many conditions where symptoms persist, is such that medications alone are rarely the answer. The American Pain Society has identified for chronic, non-cancer pain that mindfulness, exercise, and cognitive behavioral therapy are first-line recommendations ahead of medications. This should not be construed as stating that patients do not require medications. Rather, the acute pain may require medications to be controlled so that the patient is able to take the time necessary to benefit from one or more of these 3 recommended therapies. Now, Cherkins et al. Did a randomized control trial of just over 300 patients with back pain for greater than 3 months. And actually, the mean duration was 7 years. Now, they were randomized into 3 groups. They had cognitive behavioral therapy, mindfulness, or usual care. The intervention groups had greater clinical meaningful improvement. So there was a 61% for cognitive behavioral therapy and 58% for mindfulness. And this was in comparison to 45% for usual care. However, we need to be cautious interpreting these results because of the potential placebo effect. Now, patients should not be counseled, though, just to rest in bed or have minimal activity, but encouraged to do as much as they can to start rehabilitation exercises as soon as possible. Now, some have advocated for chiropractic care. A 2010 study from Canada by Bishop et al. Had 92 patients with acute low back pain. They showed significant improvement in functionality at 4 weeks with chiropractic care as compared to general practitioners providing usual care. But the big problem with these types of studies is they're not blinded, and this introduces, again, a potentially large placebo effect. I'm not aware of any high-quality evidence demonstrating the efficacy of chiropractic care. And there's also concerns about applying chiropractic care to the neck, its use in children, and discouraging immunization. Until there is a well-designed study that's published, I'm not going to be recommending chiropractic care. Acupuncture is another non-pharmacologic treatment modality that has been tried for acute low back pain. It would take way more than a 30-minute lecture to adequately address this topic. However, there was a study recently published looking at acupuncture specifically performed in the emergency department, and it included patients with back pain. And it compared it to pharmacological therapy alone, acupuncture alone, or a combo of both pharmacotherapy and acupuncture. The primary outcome was no difference in clinical or statistical relative reduction of pain at 1 hour between the groups. Specifically, all three groups had equally terrible reduction in pain. Specifically, less than 20% of the patients had a clinical reduction of their pain. 20%, that's it. Less than 20%. And less than 40% had a statistical reduction in pain. Now, there were many limitations to this study, including a lack of blinding, no sham acupuncture group, a straw man comparison, and selection bias. With no high-quality studies demonstrating efficacy of acupuncture, again, I'm just going to have to accept the null hypothesis and not recommend this non-pharmacologic treatment modality. Now, just to tie up the pharmacological and non-pharmacological treatments together, there was a systematic review published in December 2017, and they found 19 studies, and this is by Ashbrook et al. In the Emergency Medicine Journal. So this group found 19 studies with almost 2,000 patients, and it concluded that we need more high-quality studies to provide evidence-based care. Okay, that brings us to question number 5. How long will I have this back pain? A human is an animal not meant to be upright. Back pain should be expected at some point in almost everyone. When mechanical back pain does occur, ongoing core muscle activity associated with almost all movements ensure that healing will be prolonged and often incomplete, especially when targeted muscles reconditioning is not part of the treatment plan. It is inherent that we as physicians understand the normal historical history that demonstrates that 60% of patients will have some pain and loss of function at a year, and that there is almost no functional gain after 3 months. It's inappropriate to advise these patients that they will be better in about a week or even after a few weeks. How long it takes any given patient to improve is unknown when a patient is first seen in the emergency department with acute back pain. Now, this information comes from a systematic review of prospective cohort studies, which means observational studies, so associations only. And these studies were done in the primary care setting, and it shows high rates of persistent low back pain after 1 year. Donaldson et al. Reported a survey from about 600 clinic patients, and the clinics were primary care, physical therapy, chiropractic, and surgical spine clinics, and these were in North America and Europe. This study demonstrated some patients will have frequent and persistent low back pain, but the limitation to the Donaldson study is that they were convenient, not consecutively recruited patients. We like to see every single patient included, not a convenient sample. Also, I'm concerned about the external validity and selection bias and recall bias in this type of study. And finally, these were not emergency department patients, but patients in an outpatient clinic setting. There is a systematic review and meta-analysis of 43 observational studies and 33 prospective cohort studies. In fact, they specifically excluded randomized clinical control trials. And they had about 11,000 patients with non-specific low back pain. And they found it took weeks to months, and some patients still had pain and disability at 1 year. So we need to set expectations appropriately, while at the same time not setting patients up for failure. So we need to set expectations appropriately, while at the same time not setting patients up for failure. Patients with chronic pain are often unemployed and socially isolated. They can develop hopelessness, helplessness mindset that needs to be avoided. Managing expectations at that first emergency department visit is a key step in their care. Try to be supportive, at the same time being realistic. Well, those are the 5 points. So now we're going to go to the take to work points. The first one is, while we use red flags every day in our assessment of low back pain, example, tuna fish, we need to recognize that the evidence supporting the value of those indicators is of low quality. The second point is imaging should be reserved for patients with specific indications or red flags. Non-traumatic back dominant low back pain is not one of them, and MRIs rarely change management in these patients. The third take to work point is opioids have a role in short-term management of acute severe low back pain. ASAP has some guidelines and policies on the subject of opioid use. Unfortunately, the other non-opioid pharmacologic therapies have very limited evidence of efficacy. However, ketamine is showing promise as an adjunct in subdissociative doses. The fourth point is there is some value of mindfulness, cognitive behavioral therapy, and exercise. Evidence for other non-pharmacologic treatments such as chiropractic and acupuncture are of low quality and cannot be recommended based on the existing literature. And the fifth and final take-to-work point, manage patients' expectations. Do not meet them. Many patients will have ongoing pain and functional limitations for weeks to months after their acute injury. Don't set them up for failure and try to be sympathetic. Well, there you go. That's it for Time to Talk a Little Nerdy about acute and chronic back pain. It does only represent a starting point, and I would encourage you to be skeptical of what you've just heard and go back and read the primary literature yourself. And remember, you've got to get a little nerdy to provide patients with the best care. Happy Valentine's Day, and I'll be back to talk a little nerdy in March. I'm Ken Milne.
Hi, everybody. This is Jerry Huffman, and this is the February 2018 edition of my so-called Reflections of a Skeptic. This month, I'm going to be talking about a few methodologic issues and reviewing the literature, in particular, chart reviews. And I have been thinking about doing a series of reflections on study methodology, because it's something that I've spent much of my career doing, and which is really important for reviewing medical literature for things like EMA and PCMA. We report to you about all sorts of studies, but we try to do it critically rather than uncritically. And in order to do it critically, you have to have some sense of what are decent methods and what are ways in which methodologic problems can lead to bias. Bias in the sense here of introducing error in a non-random fashion into the results of a study. And unfortunately, there's no way to do a perfect study. And even more unfortunately, most people don't even try. Many studies are nowhere near perfect. And the methodologic problems that they have lead to erroneous results and can fool us all. It's not greatly surprising to me or to anybody who studied studies and study methodology when John Ioannidis published a famous paper about half of all published results are not correct. So why does that happen? Well, there are a lot of reasons why that happens, but one of them has to do with methodology. So I'm going to spend a little bit of time talking about it today. The reason I decided to do it now was because last month when I was reviewing EMA, I was stunned to find that almost two-thirds of the papers, the methodology was a review of charts. I went back and looked at charts and came up with some data. And yeah, it's pretty common in the medical literature. I don't think two-thirds of all papers, but a lot of papers are chart reviews. But what was particularly striking when I was trying to analyze the individual papers was that almost all of them suffered from the same massive methodologic problems. And I've spent a lot of time talking about this. Long-time listeners will have heard me mention many times chart reviews, that there's a methodology you're supposed to use. And we're going to get into all that today. But the reason I was prompted to do this was because of all the studies last month, or close to 20, that involved a chart review, only one of them told us much of anything about how they did the chart review. That study did it really well. The others don't tell us. Maybe they all did it really well as well, but they just forgot to mention it. But I suspect that's not true. When they don't write down, here's how we did the chart review, you can be pretty sure that it was what's called an implicit chart review. They looked at charts and they said, oh, look at that. That's interesting. And they wrote it down rather than using the methods that I'm going to tell you about now. It's really important because chart reviews, even when done perfectly, usually can't give you much in the way of answers. And I'm going to tell you why about that in a minute. But that's when done perfectly. When done imperfectly, they are a disaster. Because when you just sort of look at charts and you see what's in there, you can find just about anything you want. And in fact, I've done that with trainees on several occasions where we did an unstructured part review and then we did the same chart review again using the formal methodology, and we found that the results changed completely. So I'm going to spend a little time today, most of my time today, talking about chart reviews. But last month when I was doing these, there are two other big methodologic issues arose, and I just want to briefly mention them. I probably will address them in some different reflections at some other time. One of these had to do with the notion of association is not the same as causation, and the other had to do with the effect of chance when you go looking at data and snooping in it. And so data snooping, I look at a big set of data, even if you look well, you did a good chart review, but I'm looking at a lot of data, you're going to find all sorts of things that aren't true just by chance alone. That's sometimes called data snooping. Sometimes it's called data dredging, or even worse, data torturing. If you torture the data enough, it will confess to anything you want it to say. So I want to spend 1 minute on each of those two. In terms of data dredging, it's just the notion of chance. So if you think about rare events, am I going to win the lottery? If you go buy a lottery ticket, you're just throwing away money. You're not going to win the lottery. But if a zillion people buy a lottery ticket, one of them is going to win the lottery. The chance of anyone winning is zero. The chance of someone winning is one. How does that happen? Well, when you multiply very, very rare possibilities many, many, many times, you discover that extraordinarily unusual things do happen. They just don't happen very often. Let me give you an example of what I'm talking about and why this relates to data dredging. If you said to somebody, what's the chance that these two people have the same birthday? If you think about it, there's 365 days. It's one out of 365 that any two people have the same birthday. But if you get a lot of people in a room and you ask them individually to say what their birthday is, do you know how many people you have to ask before two people have the same birthday? I don't remember the exact number. I think it's 21 or 22. It's not 365. It's not close to 365. How did that happen? Well, because you're making multiple possible comparisons. And by doing so, you're increasing the chance of what seems like a strange event happening greatly. So the first person has only a 1 in 365 chance of having the same birthday as the person before. But the second person now has 2 out of 365 because there are two people have mentioned their thing. And the third one has 3 and the fourth has 4. And pretty soon, you're starting to do where there's a lot of there's already 15 birthdays out there, and the next one has a significant chance. And when you add up the numbers, it turns out you don't need, it's way less than 30. I don't remember the exact number. It's way less than 30. It sounds strange, but it really happens. And why is this relevant to looking at big data, which is unfortunately one of the most common bases for publication in the medical literature today, is because when they go look at it and you just sort of see what's in there, you're going to find all sorts of strange things because you're not looking for one possible association, but you're looking for a million possible associations. And guess what? You'll find not just one, you'll find a whole bunch of associations that have nothing to do with reality. They just happen to happen by chance alone. So somebody did this in medicine with a data set where they looked at the mega trials for thrombolytic therapy, and they found that the response to different drugs depended upon the sign under which you were born. You did better with TPA with one sign and worse with TPA with a different sign. And it's not because that's really true. It's because you're making many different comparisons. Another famous example was steroids for spinal trauma, where famously Dr. Bracken claimed that even though the large entire study of giving steroids didn't help, if you looked at the people who got it under 8 hours, it did help. Now you might say, that makes sense. Earlier is better. Why shouldn't we believe that? But there's a lot of reason why you shouldn't believe it, including that he didn't just look at under 8 hours. He looked at under 2 hours, under 3 hours, under 4 hours, or 5 hours. He looked at every possible breakpoint. And in fact, the only one that worked, not under 9 hours, not under 10 hours, not under 7 hours, the one that worked was under 8 hours. In fact, they had done many, many different comparisons. The more comparisons you do, the more likely you will find something that is meaningless. But if you find a lot of things that are meaningless, a few of them will seem to make sense. So the best you can do with that type of data dredging is generate hypothesis. It looks like under 8 hours might be better. It was associated with better. Let's now test it. But if you don't test it, you should never make that claim. Now, if you really did something where you only looked at under 8 hours and there was a good reason, it was your primary hypothesis, even then it doesn't prove it, but at least that's better. But if you're looking at many possible outcomes, the more you look at, the less likely it is that what you find is going to be true. that's about data dredging. A little bit about cause and association. Again, I don't want to spend a lot of time on this, but Koch, Dr. Koch, Robert Koch, from 19th century Germany, made his famous hypotheses about how do you prove that one thing causes another. And he had four conditions, and we now know that those really aren't true. I mean, they knew it even then. He said, if A causes B, every time you have A, you'll get B. Every time you have B, you will have had A before. That was two of the four things. We know that neither of those is true. Hepatitis B virus causes hepatitis, but not everybody who's exposed to hepatitis B virus gets hepatitis. And not everybody who has clinical hepatitis was exposed to hepatitis B virus, because there are other causes. There are many examples of why Koch's hypotheses are not exactly correct. But how do we know A causes B? Well, first of all, A has to come before B. If A came after B, it probably didn't cause it. But in addition, you have to figure out that the two are not just related in some way, but they're related in a way that doesn't depend on other factors. And those other factors are called confounders. And confounding is tremendously important in science and in the medical literature. So let me give you an example. Alcohol is associated with lung cancer. People who have lung cancer drink more alcohol than people who don't have lung cancer. Now, on the surface of it, you might say, well, a beer causes lung cancer. But if you think about it, it's not that hard to figure out, because people who drink beer also are more likely to smoke than people who don't smoke, who don't drink beer. So there's an association, not because alcohol causes cancer, because alcohol is associated with cigarettes, and cigarettes cause lung cancer. Okay, so confounding is really, really important. Now, how do we deal with that in medicine? Well, it turns out that, of course, the gold standard for proving causation is a randomized controlled trial. And why is that? Because in a randomized controlled trial, you control for all those potential confounders. That is to say, you randomize it so you hope that just by chance, you're not just getting the people who not only drink beer but also smoke cigarettes, but you're making it likely that the cigarette smokers will be equal in both groups. And all you're looking at is whether or not they drink beer. Even that's not perfect. Sometimes, just by chance alone, the two groups aren't the same. But randomization, particularly when you have a fairly large study cohort, usually does a pretty good job of making the groups seem the same. Usually. Not always. Usually. So usually it gets rid of confounders. And what's more, it not only gets rid of confounders like smoking, but it gets rid of confounders that you never even would have thought of, because you didn't know that they were causes of cancer. Like, does the person live next to a nuclear reactor, or is there radon in the air, or whatever it is. So when you don't randomize, you can try to control for confounders by going back into the data and looking how many people also smoked, how many lived near a factory, etc., etc. But you can only control for the ones you're looking for. And in addition, that type of controlling never does anything close to a perfect job. So it's really important to remember that association and cause are not the same thing. And by the way, I just said randomized trial is the gold standard for looking for causation, but it's not the gold standard for looking for adverse effects. And I've talked about that in the past before, and it's really important to mention that most randomized trials are not powered to find adverse effects. They only find the adverse effects that they look for. They only find those that are reported. They're done in special populations, usually to control and limit adverse effects. There are many reasons why they're not really good for saying, this drug, yes, it does work. It causes a better outcome. But it's not a good way to know that it didn't cause problems. It was safe. So anyway, those are two side issues. What I really wanted to talk about was chart reviews. And so I'll go back to mention that there's a famous study that I've cited many, many times by Gilbert and Lowenstein in the Annals of Emergency Medicine, March 1996, in which they reviewed a whole bunch of chart reviews to look at their methodology. And they found, not surprisingly, that most of them didn't do what you're supposed to do. Now, the reason I always cite that paper is not because what they found, but because they have a table in there which says, here are some of the things you're supposed to do when you do a chart review. And I'm going to go over some of those things now. That's not the only study that does it. In the abstracts database, both PCMA and EMA, we have two other papers that do maybe even a better job of describing the methodologic bases for doing a good chart review. One's by Worcester in Academic Emergency Medicine in February 2004, and one is by Badcock and Anne-Marie Kelly in Annals of Emergency Medicine in April of 2005. So let's go back for a second. If you go look at a chart and you want to see what's in there, and you just sort of look, you can find almost anything you want. What are problems with just going to look at a chart? Well, some biggies that jump to mind is, what if what you're looking for isn't in there? So you want to know what's the quality of chest pain that's associated with an MI? So you look at the people who have an MI and the people who didn't have an MI, and you say, are there differences in how they describe their chest pain? Well, what if when you go look at the chart, it doesn't mention what the quality of the chest pain was? Absent data is a really big problem with chart reviews. If you're doing a prospective study, you can say, ask every patient, does it feel heavy? Does it feel like pressure? Does it feel sharp? But if you're just looking at a chart, it may not say that. What's more, what if it says heavy? Is heavy the same as pressure? If it says squeezing, is that the same as pressure? If you want to know what the person meant, you'd have to define it very precisely, and charts very often don't. And what about if there are three notes on there? And one says heavy and one says sharp. Which one do you believe? So there's big problems with just going exploring data. Missing data, conflicting data, not well-defined data, and even things like vital signs, where it's always there, you can get into big problems. So you want to know whether or not the drug decreased anxiety, and you defined anxiety as a decrease in heart rate of 10 or more. Well, you go look at the chart, and there's lots of problems there. One is, does going from 170 to 160, is that the same as going from 110 to 100, or 80 to 70, or what about from 50 to 40? How do you interpret the same drop in heart rate? Oh, but it's worse than that. What if there are four vital signs on the chart, and one's 120, and one's 104, and the next one's 112? Did they drop? Did it drop after the medicine? It was 5 minutes after the medicine, or it was 2 hours after the medicine? Can you ascribe it to the medicine? There are many ways in which whatever the data is on the chart can be interpreted in different ways. So that even under the best of circumstances, you're often going to be missing important information or misunderstanding what the chart actually said, not to mention that the chart may, of course, get it wrong. Somebody may have just written down, I'm supposed to write vital signs, I didn't check them, so I'll just write something here, whatever that is. It's very different than when you're gathering information in a prospective way, but that's under the best of circumstances. So what are you supposed to do if you're doing a chart review? So first of all, you should mostly be doing chart reviews, looking for things where the data is pretty routinely there. Things like, did the patient die or not? What were the vital signs? Even those can get you into trouble, even the patient die or not, because you're going to look at what predicted death, and many of the things you're looking for may be influenced by the way you're looking. But without getting into more detail of that, let's just say that it's better if the data is pretty much routine there and if it doesn't need to be interpreted that much. So if you're looking at X-ray reports, for example, you better be very clear of how did you interpret what the radiologist said. Because as you know, radiologists never say anything clearly. They always hedge about it. So you have to have exact terms for when will I believe that they meant that there really was elevated ICP. So what do you do? So here's some of the things that Gilbert and Lowenstein paper says you're supposed to do. They said you're supposed to have a trained abstractor. You're supposed to go over with them. Here's how you abstract the data. And then you're supposed to monitor them periodically to make sure that they're getting it right. There has to be in the study clear inclusion and exclusion criteria. That has to be listed. The important variables have to be precisely defined. When you say the patient got better, we want to know whether or not the patient's pain got better after they got a medicine. You have to define, what do you mean by better? What if you see on the chart one thing that says pain moderate and the next one says has some pain? Is that better or is that worse? You can imagine that it can be hard to interpret. What if it says on a visual analog scale it was 70 millimeters and then it was 62 millimeters? Is that better? You better define what you mean by better. And again, of course, there could be three different notes in how you interpret them. So you have to be very precise about it. Which vital sign am I talking about? Was it only the first vital sign? Am I only looking at 10 minutes after they got the medicine? Or are you thinking the medicine might work between 15 and 35 minutes, so I'm only going to look at vital signs within that period? However it is, you have to define it precisely. There have to be standardized abstraction forms. And then you have to take some of the charts and have different abstractors look at them and see whether they agreed. And you do this using inter-rater reliability measures to see, can we really trust how they interpreted what the chart said? That's in the table in that paper that I'm talking about. But there's some other biggies that I think are even more important. Not all of these are equally important, but they're really critical ones. The abstractor should be blinded to the hypothesis of the study. So, for example, I want to know whether or not drug X made the pain better. And I like drug X, and I want to prove that it made the pain better. And I go look at the charts. When I see that the pain was moderate, and now it says has some pain, I say, oh, yeah, some pain's, that's better. And then I look at another drug, and it started out with moderate, and now says pain continues, or there is still pain. I say, oh, no, that's not better. I can find how I want, depending upon how I look at it. So I should be blinded to the hypothesis of the study. The abstractor shouldn't know about it. Even better, the abstractor who looks at which drug did the patient get should be different than the abstractor who's looking at the outcome. The person who decides whether or not the pain's better doesn't know which drug the patient got. The person who decides which drug the patient got, or the dose, or was it appropriate, or any of those things, doesn't know the outcome. Then if you make different abstractors who are blind to the hypothesis, and then some measure of inter-rater reliability, then you can at least trust whether or not they were able to interpret what the chart meant. There has to be exactly specific methods for what do you do with missing data. Just because it doesn't say whether the pain was heavy, do you record it as not heavy? Do you record it as absent? What do you do with it? Well, there are different ways you can do this. None of them's perfect. But if you don't tell us, that's really problematic. What do you do with conflicting data? If one person on the chart writes pain better and the next person says pain not better, what do you do then? How do you do this? This is really, really important. If you do all of these methods perfectly, you still won't be able to tell us much from most chart review studies. At best, you should be generating a hypothesis. If you don't do these things, you're pretty much making it up. And as I mentioned, when I reviewed last month's papers, there were close to 20 of them that told us they were reviewing some sort of chart. And one of them mentioned all these methods. That paper was really good. And within reason, you can say it really strongly suggested the conclusions they reached. The other papers, you better be really skeptical about it. Now, one thing I mentioned before is you really can't, I just want to go back to association and cause before I finish. I mentioned that if you want to know whether A causes B, you can't do it just because they're associated. The way we mostly do it is we do a randomized trial. In life, of course, we don't really do that. For things where there's an obvious cause, we don't need to even do a study. If you want to know whether or not you should wear a parachute when you jump out of a helicopter, you shouldn't do a study of it. If you want to know whether or not it's dangerous to walk across a crowded freeway with your eyes closed, you're not really going to study it. You probably would imagine that if you saw people running across the freeway drunk and they got crashed, you wouldn't have to say we needed a randomized study to say running drunk on a freeway isn't a good idea. That's because the association is overwhelming. Now, I mentioned before cigarettes and lung cancer versus alcohol and lung cancer. And obviously, the alcohol didn't cause it. It was the association with cigarettes, that the confounding that did it. But how do we know cigarettes cause lung cancer? Well, in fact, there's never been a randomized trial of cigarettes and lung cancer. It would be hard to do an ethical study where you said to people, you have to smoke 2 packs a day for 30 years, and you don't get to smoke for 30 years or at all or whatever. You can't do that. It never was done. So why do we really believe that lung cancer causes smoking? Excuse me. Smoking causes lung cancer. There was an appropriate Freudian slip. Why do we believe that? Well, sometimes when there's an association that is overwhelmingly close and which is repeated and consistent on many, many different data sets, and where there's a clear dose-response relationship, then you can get to the point where you say, this really looks like it's not just associated, but A caused B. And then you do things like you change smoking in the population culturally, where people stop smoking, and that rate of cancer drops dramatically. It's still not proof on the order of a randomized trial. Remember, even a randomized trial isn't perfect proof. Nothing is
perfect proof. I don't want to get into philosophy of science, but this is, you know, we're just getting closer to what we see looks like it really represents the truth. So when something, when an association is overwhelming, when there's no other reasonable explanation, when there's good reason to believe it's true, when it has a very strong dose-response relationship, when it's consistent across all sorts of sets, when there's before or after information that suggests that the relationship is true, then we can say, yeah, it probably is true. But absent that, just finding associations is very dangerous to jump to the notion that it's a cause. I apologize. I meant to say that before because I really wanted this mostly to be about chart reviews. So to get back to it, what I really want to say is there's a methodology for how you do chart reviews. If you do it perfectly, you're still tremendously limited. If you do it imperfectly, it really is almost like making it up. The more imperfectly, the less objective the things you're looking for, the more chance there is for confusion in how you interpret things, the worse it gets. But when you say, we reviewed charts, which is what most of these papers say in their methodology section, the methodology section in most of the medical literature is the shortest section, and then the discussion is the big one. It should be just the opposite. And it's often in many journals, it's in small print, the methodology, because it's not important. It should be just the opposite. That's what matters, is how you did it. And it doesn't matter anywhere more than it does in chart reviews because they're so frail. If you don't do it right, big, big, big problems. And unfortunately, the vast majority of them are not done right. So this is to remind you why my talks are called Reflections of a Skeptic. And I'll just remind you as well that a skeptic and a cynic are different things. A cynic is somebody who always says no, always finds a reason not to believe something. A skeptic is someone who says, wait a second, prove it to me. Not that I believe you're wrong all the time, but rather that I need a little better evidence than that. And we need to be very skeptical about the things that people claim to us. That's particularly true when they're selling us something, as happens all too often in modern medical, quote, science. But even when they're not selling us something, we have to be skeptical. So that's it for this month's Reflections, and I look forward to talking with you next time. Thanks. Bye.
Hey, ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, Mel Herbert here for That Was Then, This Is Now. This month, I want to talk a little bit about the controversy of SVT, calcium channel blockers versus adenosine, and put it in some historical perspective for you. So there is still ongoing, and it's been going for like 25 years, a big controversy about what should be first line for SVT in sort of the stable patient and even the quasi-stable patient. Which one should you give? Well, back in the day, if you're old, if you're older than me, if you trained before the early 90s, then the only real choice you had was verapamil, and it worked really well. Verapamil is an outstanding choice for stable SVT, narrow complex, regular. It works incredibly well. It worked well for decades. But then in 1989, at least here in the US, adenosine was approved. And actually in 2002, in the ACLS iteration of that year, they made adenosine first-line therapy for SVT. And since that time, there's been an ongoing controversy. And it goes like this. Adenosine is more expensive. Adenosine hurts. It has this significant side effect of crushing, horrible chest pain like you feel like you're going to die. Adenosine might be associated with a little bit less hypotension, but in the vast majority of patients, it doesn't matter. And here's really one of the most important points. The calcium channel blockers are actually more effective at converting you from SVT back to sinus rhythm than adenosine, and don't produce chest pain, and maybe have a little bit of hypotension, but in the vast majority of patients, it doesn't matter. People who argue for adenosine say, yeah, but it's so safe. It's so safe because it doesn't produce hypotension. And in patients in whom you're not sure, in whom calcium channel blockers could be really bad, for example, like ventricular tachycardia, then adenosine is way safer. If you give a calcium channel blocker to a wide, complex, regular rhythm, which is probably VTAC most of the time, they often will crash and burn. If you give adenosine to those people, it's probably pretty safe. And so that's why a lot of us started using adenosine just for the comfort of knowing if I screw up, I've got a much greater margin of error in the adenosine group than I do in the calcium channel blocker group. Let's go back to 1996, a pre-hospital care paper where Rick and Jerry discuss this. And listen carefully to what Jerry says the solution is. It's not a question of adenosine versus verapamil. It's a question of giving the drug to the right person.
There's another pre-hospital care study here. It's entitled Treatment of Out-of-Hospital SVT, Adenosine versus Verapamil. This was in Academic Emergency Medicine. This study was done in Milwaukee. They looked at the use of Verapamil retrospectively, and they looked at the use of adenosine prospectively in the treatment of SVT. It was supported by the manufacturer of adenosine. The Verapamil was given to 52 of 106 patients with SVT, about half. So they were kind of antsy about giving it in those cases. Adenosine, geez, they used it in 83% of 105 patients who had SVT, so their threshold for use was much lower, obviously. The conversion rate, 69% with adenosine, 88% with Verapamil. This is very interesting. The initial rhythm was misinterpreted 39% of the time when they gave adenosine. But because adenosine is so safe, it didn't matter.
At least because they thought it was so safe. In other words, they used it when they weren't sure what the rhythm was. It was very little more cautious with the Verapamil.
Two patients with wide complex tachycardias given Verapamil had cardiovascular collapse. They also pointed out that the conversion in hemodynamically unstable patients, the patients who we really ought to be concerned about, was actually better with Verapamil. It was 5 of 5 versus 13 of 20 given adenosine.
Right.
The recurrence rates were very similar. You know, there's a common belief that you get more recurrences with adenosine, although they were not statistically different. The numbers of recurrences were so small that maybe there was not.
Yeah, and there was a trend towards more in the adenosine group in this study as well. The authors conclude that adenosine was just as good and maybe better because you can use it more safely. But it's interesting. This is a sponsored study, and actually the results, if anything, suggest that Verapamil is better. It worked better in the hemodynamically unstable. It converted many more of the patients, and I think you didn't mention that the cost of the adenosine was almost three times that of the Verapamil, and adenosine, of course, has much more symptomatic adverse effects than Verapamil does, although we're not talking about severe hypertension. We are talking about severe chest pain. I think an appropriate response to this is to say that you shouldn't use Verapamil in inappropriate patients like those with wide, complex tachycardias, but that otherwise everything I read suggests that Verapamil is a better first choice. Obviously, you don't want to give it to people who are going to misuse it. It has potential for harm if it's misused.
Well, that's maybe the reason they use it in pre-hospital care, where it's being given by paramedic, you don't necessarily...
Better to teach people not to use it in wide complex tachycardia. And if you want to use something there, then adenosine may be okay, probably safer, although not 100% safe. There are a couple of case reports of bad outcomes. In addition, it doesn't work all that well, because usually wide complex tachycardia is VTAC. It's not SVT with aberrancy.
So is adenosine safe in wide complex tachycardias, therefore that's why a lot of people are still using it? Well, I think the answer to that is, yeah, it seems pretty safe. In fact, I wrote an article 20 years ago. One of the first papers I actually ever wrote was about this topic. Rick and Jerry did a nice review of that paper and bring up the really clearly most important and salient points.
Abstract number 3 is by our friend and colleague Mel Herbert.
And Scott Vody.
Scott's the residency director at UCLA, and Mel is the director of education at Olive View, which is where the doctors really learn to see patients. The Olive View is affiliate of. I won't say that. Adenosine and wide complex tachycardia. This is a review. It's got 15 references about the use of this drug in wide complex tachycardia. By way of reminder, Mel points out, and as does Scott, that this is used for the conversion of regular rapid rhythms. It won't do much if you have an irregular rhythm, like AFib, because it's not going to slow it down. You might get a little...
Could slow it down for 5 seconds.
Well, it won't even do that. It may temporarily cause a little AV nodal block, but it's going to go away. But it's really used for wide complex tachycardias that are regular. They talk about SVT with aberration, WPW, SVT, VTAC, all nasty things, where it may help, not likely to help,
well,
but won't hurt necessarily.
No, I don't think that's a fair summary.
You don't think it's a fair summary?
No. Adenosine is for narrow complex tachycardias, just as Verapamil is. However, in wide complex tachycardia, where you think it's supraventricular in origin, Verapamil is potentially really dangerous if you give it, and it turns out it isn't supraventricular, it's really ventricular. Adenosine is also dangerous, but much less so because its effect lasts so short. So if you have a wide complex tachycardia, you really want to know, is this really ventricular or is it supraventricular with aberrancy?
We don't know.
So this is a place where adenosine may give you the answer. But if it is ventricular, which it usually is, it won't help. And so it's not a treatment for wide complex tachycardia, but in some cases of wide complex tachycardia that are of supraventricular origin, it may be useful or it may be diagnostic.
Wasn't that what I was going to say?
The other important part about this is that in wide complex irregular tachycardia, where it may be WPW with atrial fibrillation, adenosine, like Verapamil, is potentially
terrible. It can cause fatality because it will not have any positive effect, and it may actually speed conduction through the bypass tract, and that could lead to VFib and death. And there has been one or two case reports of this, just as there have been a few case reports with verapamil. So in white complex tachycardia, don't use verapamil. In white complex irregular tachycardia, don't even try adenosine.
But even if you gave it,
it's not likely to help.
It's going to wear off in 18 nanoseconds.
Right. But it may also be really bad.
It's a chemical electric shock.
Well, let's fast forward 10 years. Again, Rick and Jerry, they're discussing a new paper and a new way of giving calcium channel blockers, the idea of slow infusion. Now, if you're practicing today, this might be routine for you. But it wasn't routine back in the day. 10 years ago, these papers started to come out. This was one of the first and one of the best ones. You see, prior to this, what we tended to do was give big boluses of calcium channel blockers. And then if it didn't work, we gave another big bolus. And many of us realized that in particularly the older patient, the skinny patient, the quasi-stable patient, that could be a big problem. So the slow infusion, I think, has really been a significant advance in how to give the calcium channel blocker.
Number eight, Jerry.
Number eight. I think this is an important paper, a very well-done paper. Slow infusion of calcium channel blockers versus adenosine for SVT. This is by Lim in the journal Resuscitation from Singapore. 200 patients, just over 200, with SVT, randomized to adenosine versus a calcium blocker, mostly verapamil, but also diltiazem. And the little twist on this is they said, let's do it slowly. That way we won't have any bad side effects from the calcium blockers. I'm not going to go through all the doses, but they're pretty much standard. Normal sinus rhythm, 99% with the calcium blocker, 86% with the adenosine. Then they crossed over the failures. All 14 who failed adenosine converted with the calcium blocker. Of the two calcium blocker failures, one converted with adenosine, one needed to be shocked. So way, way better for the calcium blocker. And guess what? That's what the literature shows. We've been using adenosine, or people have been pushing adenosine for a long time, and I've always claimed that, gee, that didn't make sense because calcium blockers are so great. Why do we even need this? Causes chest pain. It's more expensive. And when you actually looked at the literature, I think we did a meta-analysis about this recently, said all the trends are in favor of the calcium blockers. Now, this is a little twist on it. It says give the calcium blocker slowly. It's safe and effective. I personally think that may be true, but giving it the old way is also safe and effective. So I've been using calcium blocker for SVT for the longest time. I used adenosine a couple of times when we first started. The patients really didn't like it because of all the chest pain, and I didn't see any reason to give it. It wasn't better, and in fact, it turns out pretty clearly this goes along with other studies, which says it's not quite as good.
Yeah, I agree. I'm still basically in the stone age of verapamil. They said, diltiazem was going to cause less hypotension. Well, the fact is it rarely causes hypotension, either drug, and if it does, there are the papers that we did that said, give a little calcium.
Right.
Some people even say, pre-treat with calcium. I don't know that you need to do that, but the fact of the matter is this stuff works really well. It used to work really well. Now this new drug coming along, which was basically somebody hitting you in the chest with a baseball bat, and said, okay, this is the new therapy.
It's not new anymore. It's been 25 years. But yeah, no, I agree. To me, it never made any sense. I remember when verapamil first came out for SVT, and it was like a godsend, because before that, you couldn't treat SVT. You know, you could press on a carotid. It didn't work. The people who it worked, they didn't come in. They were at home. They knew it to press on the carotid.
Well, what about the people who put their head in the cold water?
Little babies and all that stuff. There was all those things.
Hypothermia.
But the interesting thing, the diving reflex. But
yes.
You know, when adenosine came out and it seemed like it was also great, turns out it's not quite as great, but it seemed like it was also great, I thought to myself, what a shame. We already have a treatment for that. We don't need a new one. We need a new treatment for other things.
Take it back and make a new treatment for something else we don't have a treatment for.
But it turns out that adenosine has some disadvantages. It was more expensive. I don't know if it is anymore. It causes really bad chest pain that patients don't like, and it isn't as effective. So,
other than that,
why would you use it?
So there you have it, 20 years, over 20 years of literature on this topic, adenosine versus calcium channel blockers in the treatment of SVT. And I think we're right back to where we were at the beginning. You can choose either. There's upsides and downsides to both. You maybe are going to get a little less hypotension with the adenosine, and it's safer, or at least appears to be safer, in patients with wide complex tachycardias.
I guess the other way of saying that is calcium channel blockers in patients with wide complex tachycardias is really bad. Don't do that. But adenosine is associated with a significant side effect. That chest pain is horrible, really bad. And people often don't want to ever have it again after having it just once. And remember also that adenosine, you know, doesn't work as well as calcium channel blockers. You should also know, just as an aside, that adenosine gets, you know, antagonized by methylxanthines. That used to be a big deal when we were giving theophylline a lot and people would go into SVT. Adenosine doesn't work very well at all in those patients. And you should also know that adenosine is, you know, really effective in patients who have central lines because it drops that adenosine right into the heart and doesn't have time to metabolize, so use a lower dose. And people with heart transplants who have upregulation of their adenosine receptors, it is spectacularly effective. So again, you have to reduce the dose. Use something like 3 milligrams or even less. And I'm sure the pediatricians would want me to say something about calcium channel blockers in little kids. In kids less than age at least 1 year, some people say 2 years, some people even say 5 years, you don't use calcium channel blockers because there's not enough calcium. That reticular endothelium thing, it's not very well developed. So they like to use adenosine. Because those calcium channel blockers in the little kids, a lot of hypotension, sometimes cardiovascular collapse. Oh, and on a practical note, the dose of diltiazem by slow infusion is 2.5 milligrams per minute, up to a total dose of 50 milligrams. I really think that's been a significant improvement in the way we give calcium channel blockers. Instead of the big boluses, now we smooth it out, 2.5 milligrams per minute with diltiazem, up to about 50 milligrams. Usually takes about 10 minutes to work. So ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, the controversy will continue. There'll be those people who say that the safety profile of adenosine outweighs everything. I will only ever use that. And there are other people who will say the side effects of adenosine, that chest pain is so bad, I will never use it, except under very specific circumstances. But now you have some historical background as to where we've come from and where we are and the arguments on both sides of that story. My name's Mel Herbert. That was then, and this is now.
Well, Raman, that wraps up the February edition of EMA, and we have Stuart here with us to kind of wrap up the whole thing. So, guys, what do you think was the highlight of the month for you?
Like, if I had to pick the paper that I liked the best?
Yeah.
Okay, for me, it's the Lazarus paper.
Okay, why?
And you're like, why? because for me, that's the most helpful paper for interns, like I was, when you're scared to pronounce someone dead. Now you have, like, a rule of thumb. Wait 10 minutes, go back in, and then you could tell the nurse that you're signing off on it.
All right, I like it. Okay.
You're not dead until you're 10 minutes later and dead. That's what I'm trying to tell you.
Dead plus 10 minutes?
Yes.
That's the new formula.
Cold and 10 minutes later
and
dead.
And you know my least favorite one. I told you at the beginning, the clavicle one, because I think that that's, you know, probably a problem to operate on every mildly displaced mid-shaft clavicle fracture.
And Raman?
This was a pretty good smorgasbord of papers this month, but I'll go with the haloperidol versus conventional therapy for gastroparesis.
Okay.
Gives me something practical. Gastroparesis patients are always miserable, and this gives me something to offer them.
What was the stinker of the month for you?
Oh, God, there was a couple stinkers.
Well, I'm also not happy about the API paper because I think it's one of a body of papers mm-hmm. that kind of might lead us to do the wrong thing.
Yeah.
And to suggest that it's sort of solid evidence that you can wait on APIs. I think it's a little bit...
I agree.
Yeah, so that one gave me a little bit of consternation.
Yeah, I think it kind of is a dangerous paper. I agree with that. Raman, what about your stinker?
My stinker, I'll say IV Mag, the Qatari paper,
uh-huh.
the one where they didn't control for anything and didn't give us anything to look forward to for bronchiolitis.
IV Mag and bronchiolitis is a stinker of a paper. Okay, my favorite paper of the month was the paper on the Affordable Care Act and how ED visits went up, just because I'm kind of fascinated by that, and it was interesting to see that data. Makes you really step back and ask that question about really, you know, what are you designing and where is the value in the healthcare system? And my stinker of the month was that Glasgow motor scale paper, the total Glasgow versus, you know, the GCS versus the motor GCS. I just, you know, I shrugged my shoulders. Why?
Don't know what to do with it.
Why? All right. Well, February has been a fun month. Thanks for listening, everybody. For March 2018, the preview is that it's going to be me and Billy together. So Raman gets a month off, going to sit in the sun somewhere and take a vacation, Raman.
Yep. I'm out. Billy's in.
All right. So thanks, everybody, for listening. We look forward to hearing your feedback and your comments on the website. And we really appreciate you joining us. We'll see you again next month.
Thanks a lot, Jen.
Thanks, Jen. Thanks, Stuart.
But no thanks to Raman.
No. No,
you're chopped liver.